And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I'm coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice flight space travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will safely be traveling with us. Tonight, we have a very special guest, the indomitable, absolutely irrefutable Stan Deo, is coming on X Squared Radio with me. And there is a lot going on. Oh my gosh, so much in the news this week. Stuff that we're interested in here. The solar wind is 355 kilometers per second, and the proton count just tripled to almost 5.0 per cubic centimeter. There are five sunspot clusters on the sun, which is quite active today. AR 1675 has just unleashed the most intense flare of the year so far, with an M1.9 class explosion today. Sunspot 1671 is very large and could become unstable before it passes away from Earth. There's a massive magnetic filament coming around that could whip out into space as well. When the sun goes down tonight, should be pretty much down nationwide. Step outside and look south. The moon is passing Jupiter in the constellation Taurus. It's a pretty close encounter, visible even through city lights. And there has been a lot going on in space lately. I mean local space. Many of you are familiar with the asteroid, that meteorite that passed into Russian skies late this week. A meteor streaked across the sky. I mean, those traffic cameras were just amazing. It exploded over Russia's Ural Mountains with the power of an atomic bomb. The spectacle deeply frightened many Russians, like it was, "Hello, we're not watching," with some elderly women declaring that the world was coming to an end, and rightly so. The meteor, estimated to be about 10 tons, that's enough to ruin the planet's day, entered the Earth's atmosphere at hypersonic speed of about 33,000 miles per hour. Of course, it shattered into pieces about, 30 to 50 kilometers up. That's about 20 miles or so above the ground. That's definitely, above where the jets fly, but enough to leave one whale of a sonic boom. There was panic, to be sure. People had no idea what was happening, said Sergei Hamatov, a resident of Chelyabinsk, the city of 1 million. That's about the size of the city of Charlotte, not far from where I am. He says, "We saw a big burst of light, then went outside to see what it was. It was too late. They heard a really loud sonic boom, which was traveling at about the speed of sound through the upper atmosphere. It took a long time to come down, much longer than the asteroid took to go overhead. The meteor hit less than a day before asteroid 2012 DA14 passed by, safely, by the way, at about 17,000 miles out. That's well inside the orbit of most geosynchronous satellites at 23,500 miles out. Geosynchronous means they're above the same piece of real estate all the time. GPS satellites, TV satellites, you know, if you have the old days, the olden days, when we had a satellite dish in your backyard that you aimed up at space somewhere around 23 degrees in the southwest sky, you could pick up a satellite, and your satellite just didn't have to track because it stayed right there locked into that LNA in your satellite dish. Well, that meteor passed inside of those, and fortunately it didn't take out any of them. The meteor released several kilotons of energy above the region. It was about 15 meters wide before it hit the atmosphere, and about one-third that size when it was done. Some meteorite fragments fell in a reservoir outside the town of Chirbarkul. The crash left an 8-meter-wide crater in the ice. The shockwave blew an estimated 100,000 square meters of glass, according to the city officials, who said 3,000 buildings in the city were damaged. At one zinc factory, part of the roof collapsed. Some of the office cams that were running at the time were quite spectacular. You could just imagine how frightened those people were. A boom that loud and a concussion blowing in the windows and doors. You know, meteors typically cause sizable sonic booms only when they enter the atmosphere because they build up a shock wave in front of them, and of course they travel faster than the speed of sound. Meteoroids are small pieces of space debris, usually parts of comets or asteroids that are on the collision course with Earth. They become meteors when they enter the Earth's atmosphere. Most meteors burn up in the atmosphere, but if they survive the frictional heating and strike the surface of the Earth, they're called meteorites. And you can hunt for them and make money off of them. They're magnetic, most of them, because they're iron. The site of Friday's spectacular show is about 5,000 kilometers west of Tunguska, which, if you'll recall, in 1908 was the site of the largest recorded explosion of a space object plunging to Earth. Many scientists believe that small object was about the size of a softball and was antimatter, and that's why it created such a concussion and laid forests to rest. I mean, just laid them out. It did prompt an array of reactions from prominent Russians as well as ordinary people. Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, speaking at an economic forum in the Siberian city of Krasnoyarsk, said the meteor could be a symbol for the forum, showing that not only the economy is vulnerable, but the whole planet. How timely. Vladimir Zhirinovsky, a nationalist leader, noted for his vehement statements, blamed, of course, the Americans. It's not meteors falling. It's the test of a new weapon by the Americans, the RIA. Novosti News Agency quoted him as saying. Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin and the incident said the incident showed the need for leading world powers to develop a system to intercept objects falling from space. Interestingly enough, none of the Russian radar picked up the object coming into their airspace. The University of Hawaii has proposed a cheaper, simpler system of detecting these meteorites, a system known as ATLAS, the Advanced Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. And I think it's appropriately named because it will be your last alert. It's to be constructed with the help of a $5 million grant from NASA. Now, wait a minute. Where did they get the money? Oh, never mind. It will consist of a series of 8 telescopes, each fitted with powerful cameras to be built on Hawaiian islands, whose clear air makes it accurate observations particularly easy, especially since software has now figured out how to take the twinkle out of stars. No, I'm serious. You know how when you look up at night and you look at some stars, they twinkle. Planets don't, but stars do. But now they have software that takes the twinkle out of the stars so they can see very clearly what's going on in space. Astronomer Professor John Tonry of Hawaii University said ATLAS, which is scheduled to begin operations in 2015, would have an extremely high sensitivity, which he compared to the detection of a match flame in New York when viewed from San Francisco. He said ATLAS would give a 1-week warning for a small asteroid, which he called a city killer, and 3 weeks for a larger county killer. That's plenty of time, don't you think? Come on. You could clean all the milk, eggs, and bread out of a store in way less time than that. Astronomers believe they have pinpointed all large asteroids whose orbits bring them close to Earth. To date, none has been found on a collision course with our planet. However, small asteroids only a few dozen meters across are very difficult to spot, but massive enough to cause local devastation. Now, they have a chart called the Hazardous Object Database, the PHA, Particularly Hazardous Asteroid Database. And the interesting thing about the database is, although they're looking all the time, supposedly, it isn't very well funded, and there are not very many government sources that are doing it. That's why you're seeing numbers like 2012 beginning for the asteroids. We have not seen them before. They're not ones that have made an orbit past us before. Otherwise, they would be called 2008 or 2010 DA something. They would not be called 2012. These are newcomers. There's all kinds of junk up there, and I maintain that as we near the galactic plane, we may have already entered into it because of December 21st, 2012, it's a gravel road up there, folks. It's been clear air until now. Now we're entering the galactic plane, the plane of gravity, more concentrated gravity out of the center of the galaxy. This is the plane upon which most of the matter of the galaxy resides, because it's like a flux line. You know, when you sprinkle those iron filings on a piece of paper and you put a magnet underneath, how the iron filings line up on the flux lines. Well, that's what metal objects do in space, is they line up on the flux line. So we're traveling through those flux lines right now, and I'm just telling you, it's a gravel road. Be ready for more. Be ready for more. Get your magnetic shovels ready. 2 minutes and counting. Stan Deyo is coming on the program. His website is standeyo.com, standeyo, D-E-Y-O.com. And you probably want to go to Stan's Corner on there, too. Lots of interesting stuff on this website. He is a regular on many, many radio programs. He has been on our program twice. We can confer with him from time to time on some of his nationally known, internationally known specialties. But there is really no end to what Stan Deyo can reach with his not only his experience, but also his intuition. We'll talk a little bit about that with him tonight, my good friend. And I'm going to call him a colleague, Stan Deyo. Welcome to the program, sir. How are you? Oh, we may not have him on yet. Okay, give me 60 seconds. There we go. Now he's on. I can see it ringing. All right. Well, they're right on time. So it's 8:14. Welcome to the program, Stan. How are you?
Good. Good evening to you, Brooks. How are things where you are?
Hey, they're going pretty good. You know, we've been the benefit of global warming down here. We had a little dusting of snow, but it's been pretty much no jacket weather here in Charlotte. How about where you are?
Well, here in Colorado, we've been having several warm days. We've been out and trimmed all the orchard trees down to get ready for the blossoms that are trying to form already.
Yeah, that would be no good. If the blossoms form and then you get a frost, you get no fruit.
Well, we had a similar thing happen last year at early spring, and fortunately, most of the trees survived it, and we had really good crops of peaches and cherries and plums and pears. But then the wind came and blew the pears right off the tree. Amazing, because they got stiff stems and snapped them all off. We had a yard full of pears.
Wow. Pear trees are kind of gnarly. I remember having one in our yard. It was not the easiest thing to climb and get fruit off of.
No, we trim them down at the top to make them bush out a bit, but as you'll recall, the pear trees are more like pencil pines. They're narrow.
Exactly.
And so anyway, basically we're having a drought here. We only got 4.5 inches where we normally get 11.5 inches of rain last year, snow or rain or anything, right?
Yep.
So we're doing what we can to hand water a number of places because I let my pipes freeze this year out in the back. We've got 70 trees to take care of. And so it's a lot of hand watering, which Holly's doing most of. But still, inconvenience. Next time I'll do it better.
I know what you mean. Well, they're now recording and talking about and putting down in the history book the drought of 2012. It was quite devastating for the Midwest and central United States. But now, since Friday, they're talking about, you know, three meteors in 3 days. What's going on up there, Stan?
Well, they're saying that 2012 DA-14 didn't have any flotsam with it in its orbit, and that the Russian meteor or meteorite now wasn't anything to do with that. But I just don't believe that. We've had, you know, over California, we've had that, and then we've had another one over China and Russia. You know, I just
It sounds like a gravel road to me. I don't know.
Well, you know, the events can be dating back for thousands of years where we had some kind of an impact on the Earth or nearby, and it splattered flotsam this way and that way, which took up different orbits. And it may well be that these don't appear to share the same orbit, but they may be have been generated by the same event ages ago. And now that when they come back into the point where, you know, something struck us and threw them out or whatever, they're arriving at a similar time and at different angles. But, coincidence, you know, the statistics behind it are so astronomical for coincidence to be down to the 20.
Unintended.
Yeah.
The thing that I try to draw when I start looking at the data is not necessarily that these things are in orbit and we're going to pass them every few years, but that coincidentally we've come to the end of the precession. We've started over. We're now in the age of Aquarius officially. And that generally means we're supposed to be lining up with this galactic plane. It's sort of like a giant galactic flux line upon which maybe all kinds of small, you know, pieces of rock are lined up, things we've never seen before, at least not in modern times.
Right.
And that maybe we're going to see a little bit more of, you know, the stars falling from heaven kind of stuff. What do you think?
There are a number of things that make me agree with you on that. The sun itself is a big driver in the orbits of things in our solar system. And the asteroid belt, I'm not too sure, but what it wasn't a fractured or destroyed moon or small planetoid, which used to occupy that orbit. But because of the dynamic pressures in our system, in the invisible fluid of space, if you wish, it's forced it to break up because the mass couldn't hold the spherical shape, you know, the spin shape it needs to generate gravity. And as a result, those like waves and arms of flotsam, you know, from the asteroid belt are coming our way and coming the way of Mars, as Phoebus and Deimos look like they are chunks of stuff that came from there. So I think that it's a state of change all the time. And what concerns me more than anything is that there's so much debris out there, you know, the size of what we saw and larger, that you can't detect unless you have some kind of a heat source or a light source on the object that you can pick it up with, you know, thermal or infrared imaging scopes or normal, astronomical scopes, you know, light scopes. If you can't determine where they are, you can't determine an orbit, you can't see them, you don't know they're there, but you suspect it. And we're going to get a lot more surprises like this. I think this is just kind of the beginning of a series of surprise meteorites.
I think I agree with you. There was one amateur astronomer with a 3-inch refracting scope. That's one without the mirror. That's one with the magnifying glass for you listeners. And he managed to pick up this asteroid and actually track it for a couple of days. But you really have to be pointed at that, you know, exact arc second of space to see it. It's not something that you could just zero in on. That being said, there are a lot of people with, 8-inch, 9-inch, 10-inch, and even 12-inch reflecting telescopes that gather a whole lot of light. And they have digital programs that do what's called cumulative photography. That is to tell you, they'll take 1,000 digital shots in a night, and then they have software that will compare all the points of light, and they will look at over time points of light that are moving. These are how most of the comets are discovered by amateurs. And the thing that worries me, Stan, is that there's no well-funded, concerted, international governmental body that's out there looking for near-Earth objects. It's all amateurs.
Well, at least that's the official statement anyway. I wonder if you and I were in charge of, you know, the American government or world government, and we knew that an extinction-level event was about to happen, whether it would behoove us to tell the people and breed anarchy immediately, or whether to hold out to the last minute and help them through leaks, et cetera, in the unofficial news sources to prepare themselves and hope that some of them survive, but certainly put the head of government and stuff underground and hope they make it. But it's, you know, people are funny. You know that.
Yeah, that's true. You know, an early warning system is more or less an early panic system.
Yeah.
We just want to go along going to the movies and going to our jobs and having our romances and worrying about whether we get, you know, free contraception or not. And then, boom, it's over. That's the way we prefer it as the general public.
Well, you know, that might be the way to go. I mean, you know, we've had people talk about, oh, what if we have a nuclear war? I said, well, if you're in Ground Zero, I wouldn't worry about it. You'd never know it happened. You know, and if you're outside of Ground Zero, Holly's got in her book how you can weather the fallout cloud for 2 weeks in situ in a home or walk out from underneath it without, you know, having to drive anywhere. But
True.
You know, why get an ulcer about it? Just do your best and live life, you know, until you die.
Well, it appears, though, that there are a lot of governments that are getting an ulcer about it, and they're building what appears to be, you know, underground complexes that take a lot of money and a lot of manpower and a lot of secret accounting to pay for.
Yeah, true. You know, I've been out of the circuit for a long time as far as what the government's doing underground, but, I mean, you know, in the 70s, the Air Force had tunnel diggers that were 22 feet in diameter, you know, like a nearly two and a half story wide tunnel they could dig underground. And then the Germans, 10, 15 years ago, developed a tunnel bore machine that would do 42 feet in diameter.
My goodness.
So, you know, they must be using these somewhere. It's not all being, you know, used to the English channel, a tunnel, you know, it's that's long gone. So where are they going with this stuff? Well, under the Denver airport.
Yeah, we've heard all those rumors before.
Yeah, I don't know.
Speaking of out west, I've read a few stories of late, and I caught a couple of your interviews on some other programs about what's going on at Yellowstone. At first I heard there was some kind of rat bacteria that had infected everybody that had visited Yellowstone, and so they were tracking everybody down and trying to get them treated, and if you caught it, it was pretty much fatal, and then that died out of the news. Then we heard that there was some kind of swelling going on in the ground, and some lake was now flooding the woods, and that was an indication that pressure was building up underneath the park. What's going on at Yellowstone? What do the folks at Nebraska have to fear?
Well, a lot of places probably need to be mindful of what's going to happen there. But back in February of last year, I was approached by an intermediary, a professional person in geology, who was indirectly connected with what's going on at Yellowstone with the USGS. And what their statement to me was is that the government had stepped in, told USGS, don't tell anybody what's going on here at Yellowstone, and put in a lot of helicopters and other types of seismic detectors all over, mainly on the northwestern side where the new vent's opening up, and to monitor, you know, second by second what was going on in Yellowstone. And so much data was being collected that they needed a supercomputer, and so they ran data connect lines out of state to other supercomputers they could tie into, which could handle the bandwidth. They told all the drivers, they told all the USGS personnel involved who knew anything about it, you will sign the National Secrets Act document here, a fine or imprisonment, if you tell anybody what's going on here. Well, of course, a way opened up that this geologist could pass the information to me, which they did. So there is something going on the northwestern side. I've seen it even when the Richter 9 hit off of the Japanese coast at Fukushima. As soon as it hit, and it wasn't like minutes delay, it was almost instantaneous, I saw a helicopter on the northwest side that was still available through one of the universities just go ape. It was showing seismic variations that, you know, were happening right then, almost in real time, in Japan. So it made me wonder if that vent that we're talking about in Yellowstone is connected directly by magma to what was underneath the Fukushima event, so that there was a hydrodynamic transfer straight through rather than waiting for PNS waves to trigger the helicopters. Anyway, there's something definitely amiss with Yellowstone, and I'm not sure whether they're expecting a full-blown eruption or whether they're just seeing magma which may break through and, you know, not explosively. It all depends upon water and whether water gets in to make, you know, a steam-type explosion when it hits the magma. That can be pretty nasty.
Well, yeah. And what we have heard in almost coordination with that are these swarm earthquakes. Reno, Nevada, under the Juan de Fuca Plate, which, by the way, a lot of people don't know this, but in World War II, we had a lot of listening phones on the floor of the ocean around the Juan de Fuca Plate because we were listening for Russian submarines and Japanese submarines. And those phones are still active, so we're still listening. And usually we just pick up whale song and, you know, rocks moving around underneath the water, things like that. But of late, like the last couple of years, we've been hearing sounds that are consistent with magma moving under the sea floor. And heretofore, it has been pretty common knowledge among geologists that there is no moving magma under the sea floor under the Juan de Fuca Plate. But 600 earthquakes in a 36-hour period made everybody put their finger on the chin and go, wait a minute, what's going on under there? And what would happen, Stan, if there was a huge underwater eruption under the Juan de Fuca Plate?
Well, actually, there is a volcano, an undersea volcano that is active. It periodically flares up there in the western side, about middle of the Juan de Fuca Plate. So I'm sure we're going to see that. Now, why they're not seeing or hearing magma movements, that's basically a function of harmonic tremors that they should be listening for. Now, they may not get harmonic tremors in the Cascadia subduction zone, which is what drives the Juan de Fuca Plate. As you know, if you have two semi-elastic plates, one diving under the other, they will tend to grab and not be a smooth flow. They'll try to hang on and release the energy, and that'll be a quake. And that's building up at the moment to what they anticipate at USGS to be a 9-plus Richter earthquake there in the Juan de Fuca Plate. What that will trigger down south of that in the San Andreas, north of that up into the Aleutians, I don't know. But there's definitely activity there. And I think the network you were talking about for the hydrophones was the SOSIS.
Yes, that's it.
Sound surveillance system that they've used.
What I'm talking about is the possibility of a tsunami in that region. And there have been tsunamis in that region in historic times there. But
well, less than 300 years ago, I think, according to the Indian records.
Exactly. And a tsunami would go, if it was in the right place, it would go right up the river. It would be devastating.
Well, yeah. And a Richter 9, in addition to tsunami, is going to shake the heck out of things. I don't like to see that kind of activity in an area of the Ring of Fire, the Arc of Fire, that has been so dormant. I mean, it's 55 years overdue for a stress release. Every other place that had the big stresses has been releasing or has released on the western and southern side of the Ring of Fire. But, you know, there's something nasty building up that could shake a lot of other fault lines, even down to Mammoth, you know, in Nevada. And so when I see these little, you know, flurries of quakes, you know, I wonder, you know, is this the beginning of the thing starting to little miniature cracks before it all goes at once or what? There's just, it's unusual.
Well, it is. And the thing about magma, which sometimes we see in Hawaii and other places around the planet, It can be particularly violent, but in that region, especially around Wyoming and around Yellowstone, it's not a huge mountain. This whole thing is like underneath the ground. And what people don't realize is that once the pressure releases from that, if the ground cracks open and the pressure releases on whatever's down there, it will flash to steam. It'll flash to superheated gas, and it will blow straight up out of the ground. And that's a tremendous amount of material that's going to be blown straight up into the stratosphere.
It has to have the water, though. It'd have to happen under the lake there, Yellowstone. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. It would have to be able to flash. It, right now, it's under so much pressure that it's staying either solid or liquid. But if pressure drops on it where it goes, according to Boyle's law, if you lower the gas pressure to a certain point, then the volume expands exponentially.
Right. It goes into the next state of matter. You know, there's a similar problem down at North Island, New Zealand, at Lake Taupo Caldera. Great trout fishing, but it's all on top of a huge volcano that hasn't erupted since about 89 AD or right around there. And the last time that one erupted, it was like Yellowstone in that it threw ash up into the air, so much of it, that the Chinese in the northern hemisphere recorded 3 days of darkness in their astronomical records because of the Lake Taupo eruption. Now then, it's been heating up, and they've sent a yellow submarine down there, you know, that they, at least from the Germans, to look for hot spots in the floor of Lake Taupo. It is a huge lake, and it's, the weight of the lake is kind of like a cap holding that magma down there. Now, if the drought kind of causes that cap to reduce in weight, and it does fracture, and also the plate twist that's happening there in New Zealand could enforce the fracture, it will be a pyroclastic type, you know, explosion as well because of the water that will drop down there. And same for Yellowstone. If it happens under that water body, it will flash. The magma itself will flash. But I just, you know, I'm hoping that the Northwest vent will bleed off some of that pressure, but it's not showing signs of it yet, as far as we know anyway.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me and why I've, you know, tried to make a go of this at X Squared Radio for 8 years is this is really a fantastic planet. And the fact that there are 7 billion of us alive now on it is no coincidence, I think. We're here, the planet's here, and there's a tremendous almost a consciousness energy that seems to be really, really pulsing stronger and stronger every day. I think because of this neural network called the internet by which we can all communicate and share thoughts and change the sociology of the human experience on a much faster basis than we've ever been able to do before. And that being said, that consciousness signal goes out into the universe. And we might not be alone in the universe.
No, I don't think we are by any means. Hey, while we were talking here, I was listening to you, but I just checked on that volcano over in the Juan de Fuca Plate you were asking about. Yeah. It's 650 feet tall. Its width is nearly 2.5 miles. It stretches nearly 9 miles. It is part of the Juan de Fuca Ridge, located about 200 miles west of Seattle. And it's the central area of this volcano contains 5 of the planet's most active hydrothermal vent fields, places where water seeps through the cracks into the seafloor and is heated as high as 716 degrees Fahrenheit by hot rock. Now, that seems like an accident waiting to happen, doesn't it?
It sure does. Even though it's under, tremendously deep and cold ocean, the fact that this stuff is venting up underneath there and you can take... I think there have been some underground camera work that's been done on this. It's really quite active. I guess the thing that's scary about it is I the advice I give people is, look, if you're going to go to the beach, go to the beach, take your pictures, and then get the heck out of there. I wouldn't live on the beach for love nor money right now. And 90% of the population of every developed country lives within 20 miles of a coast. And some of that's the major rivers, of course. But still, that means that we're very dependent or very linked to our bodies of water on our planet. And some of that means that if there's an oceanic event, and I don't mean a little 30-foot tsunami, I mean a 300 or 400-foot tsunami, it's going to be a major population change in very short order.
Yeah, I know. When people ask Holly and I, you know, where's a safe place, you can't give an answer except that, in general, do not live on the coastlines anywhere. You know, get back up into higher ground inland, no matter what country where you live. You know,
it's pretty safe, I think.
Well, we looked at biblical prophecy, which said that which is high shall be made low, that which is low shall be made high. And we thought, right, if we get about 5,000 feet, 1 mile, where we are now, then we'll be in the best of both worlds. If it gets lower or higher, we'll be good, because we're not too low, we're not too high. How's that grab you?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. You know, we're about 800 feet here, but we're several hundred miles from the coast. So
yeah, well, you know, there's earthquakes happening over just a few hundred miles west of the Canaries, where the Cumbre de Vieja is, you know, the volcano that could release a landslide that would make a tsunami hit the east coast of America.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
In the Azores, there's probably about 15 quakes I've been watching, which aren't showing up on USGS, but they are on the local stuff over there. And I'm seeing signals in my earthquake forecasting that said there's something developing there in the mid-Atlantic. And as I look at earthquakes, even just, you know, today, for the last 30 days on USGS, and looked at Richter 5 or better to narrow the field a bit, there are a huge number, like about four times, maybe five times more Richter 5-type earthquakes on the western side of the Pacific and inland up and over to the Himalayas and down into the Mediterranean, as compared to the west coast of the United States and South America. Now, it seems to be moving toward the Atlantic, toward the mid-Atlantic. And I'm seeing, you know, like, there was a quake in the mid-Atlantic, when was that? The 6th of this month, 6th of February. It was a Richter 5 right in the area where I'd expect it to start spreading. Now, that could hit the Canaries if that area continues to have these Richter 5s and better. And that could generate the tidal wave we're talking about, that, you know, several hundred feet, several hundred miles an hour, hitting the eastern states coastlines from Florida right up into D.C.
Now, the interesting thing about a shock wave like that is the ocean's very deep, you know, some places over 20,000 feet deep. But the shock wave actually is just barely subsonic, traveling through the water, and you won't even see it, well, maybe as a swell. But you won't even see it until the water starts to get shallow, like off the coast of Florida. I mean, Florida would be a sandbar if a tsunami like that came through.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look at all of our banking, all of our international communications, command and control. Everything is on the East Coast. Is there, in your opinion, a governmental awareness of this, and do they have a backup plan?
Well, I don't know about the backup plan for people in general, certainly for the continuance of government, you know, looking out for themselves. I'm sure they've done that. If they don't have to use Obamacare for the Congress, I'm sure that they've made arrangements like this to take care of themselves in the event of a tsunami or some massive EMP that wipes out American communication or something. There's rules for them and rules for us, you know.
I've heard say, though, that if there was this, you know, no tsunami warnings coming into the East Coast, even at 200 miles off, if you were in your car with the motor idling, facing away from the beach, and you floored it, you wouldn't make it away from that tsunami. It would catch you.
Well, that's probably true. And like you said, I do think the majority of this will hit the Carolinas and Florida, Florida particularly the worst, you know, in the Caribbean area there. But that's the East Coast. And, as you know, we know that we're going to, one way or another, that the world economic system and the U.S. dollar are going to be clobbered soon. There's just no way out of that.
Now, how much studying have you done that? I'm fascinated by it just as a mathematician because of the complexity of the algorithms that push, you know, on the value of the dollar. And I read, about 12 days ago that most of the major companies had written Japan off because it was 326% in debt compared to its GDP, and Fukushima was having additional pressure on the north side of the country, and you know, they had done so well on exports for so long, and now they've been in a recession for 15 years. They were just going to write them off. And all of a sudden, Japan decides to artificially mark down their currency. Many people think this is going to start a currency war. And a lot of people don't know this, but the last currency war we had was in 1931. And it was when, I believe, five countries went off the gold standard and decided to devalue their currencies to improve exports. And just to let you know that the currency war probably is going to happen, George Soros made $1 billion last month, just last month, off the Japanese yen.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, he's certainly a barometer for what's about to happen. The world economy, as you rightly said, the equations to try to solve what's about to happen if A happens or B happens, what the net result will be, there might be nearly 100 variables or more in that. It's almost as bad as trying to predict the weather. But they do make these mathematical models. That's how, you know, leading governments of the world can make kind of reasonably intelligent decisions on various things that affect the economy, whether it be war or whether it be agricultural things or import trade things, agreements. But with Japan, this may have just been forced upon them to do this to kind of neutral in a lot of ways to the West and the East confrontations. And, you know, gosh, no one could blame them. I mean, they had Fukushima, they had a big earthquake, and, you know, things have hurt them. And so in the public eye, this would be kind of a non-aggressive type way to start the currency war.
Well, that's true. But remember, the last currency war started in 1931. And in 1941, Japan had no choice but to attack its way out of it.
Well, I don't think we'll see that again. I think they're just too hurt by Fukushima and the fallout from that, literally the fallout as well. But I think that they know, they learned their lesson. They're not going to take on China. They're not going to take on the United States or Russia. They're going to make deals and perhaps be assisting and going into the Middle East for oil with China and, you know, Pakistan, whoever else might go across the Euphrates. Did you see where the Euphrates is drying up now?
I didn't. I saw where, you know, in history where that has been a key place for different kinds of appearances and governmental changes that swept the world. But I didn't know that the Euphrates was drying up.
In the book of the Revelation, there's four angels that are sent there during the time of the end times to dry up the river Euphrates to make way for the kings of the east to invade the Middle East oil fields. And this is happening right now. The Euphrates is drying up. And who are the kings of the East? Japan, China, Vietnam, Korea, all those get together and come across the dried Euphrates. They can march in and take the oil fields after Russia, the United States, and Israel are beating each other to death.
Well, you know, we talk about all the variables. Whenever we're doing a design of experiment where we're going to change a lot of variables and we're going to change them in multiple different ways, high, low, medium, We try to come together and design a mathematical model we call a DOE, or a design of experiment. You're familiar with this.
All right, yep.
And when there's a lot of variables and a lot of levels to those variables, we do what's called a fractional factorial. We calculate which ones are going to confound with each other, and then we work in the major groups of areas that are going to have the most effect, like pressure and temperature and speed and things like that. Well, in the economy, those major areas are housing, manufacturing, money supply, and of course the Dow. Now, if you look at those major areas just as major drivers in this DOE, we see the Dow continuing to climb. And I can tell you right now, based on what I see, if the Dow even reaches 20,000, it will not create one single decent paying job.
Good Lord.
It won't, because the value that's driving the Dow is not the equity or the earning power that's in the companies that make up the Dow. It's merely the value of the stock that's being traded and speculated on hundreds of times a day by supercomputers. That's what's driving the Dow. Metal is down. Gold has dropped, what, 30% in the last 2 months. Silver's down to $30 an ounce.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you'd be thinking it'd be going the other way, but it's not. Well,
it should be. It should be. But see, Morgan Stanley is the major vault that holds most of the nation's silver, actually most of the world's silver, which means they're long on silver. But they're also managing over 300,000 short contracts on silver. Now, how can you be long and short on silver at the same time? Well, it isn't illegal, Stan, but it's unethical.
It's a straddle position, yeah.
Absolutely. If the price of silver goes up, they're going to have to make those short contracts, those naked short contracts, good, which is going to destroy Morgan Stanley Bank.
Right. Sad. I say that in jest, but yeah, listen, let me go back to Japan. I just was looking up something that was in the back of my mind, wondering why Japan might be the one to do all this. Do you remember the Meadows report on for the Club of Rome back in the 70s, where they did the computer model and divided up the world into 10 socioeconomic groups? Do you remember that?
I do remember it. Vaguely, it was a white paper.
It was, but true to what they said then and what I've recorded in the Cosmic Conspiracy, I got a hold of their document and printed it. Group 3 out of 10 socioeconomic groups of the planet, Group 3 is only Japan. Group 1 has Canada and the United States, but the only one that's all by itself is Group 3 is Japan. And they're such a unique model they're a whole region of the planet of 10 regions. I mean, it's just all the other countries fall into various other groups in that 10, but Japan all by itself. And there's something odd about Japan in their modeling that makes it that way. Lord knows what it is.
Yeah, I really don't know, other than maybe the people that crafted the study, most of them were Japanese. You're talking a country that's a little bit longer than the state of Tennessee, with 84 million people living on it. And the median age in Japan is much higher than it is in the United States. They've had for a long, long time family planning, let's call it that, that has literally changed the dynamic of the demographic of Japan to what the U.S. was in 1944.
Really?
Before we had one of the highest median ages ever, because families were still poor and they weren't having kids.
Right. I know that in Japan the price of housing is so great that they're having multi-generational occupation of homes now because you can't afford to pay it off in one lifetime. So maybe that helps by having the families live together to get to that old age group there. I don't know.
Well, that's absolutely true. And have you ever lived in Japan?
No, Holly's been there, but I haven't.
Well, the interesting thing about Japan is they don't, even the nice houses don't have central heat and air. That is a luxury. What they have is a room heater or a room air conditioner, usually in the outside wall, that only heats or cools the room that the family's in at the time. And that's how they conserve energy.
Well, Holly and I do that here. So we do the same thing for the obvious reason.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a fireplace, a wood-burning fireplace, and that heats up the living room. And then it kind of gently spreads out to some of the other bedrooms around there. But that's where, we do that. And we have the European air conditioners where you have the main unit, the compressors outside, and it's only the fan and the cooling thing that's up in the house. And it just goes to a particular room. We've got two rooms that we do that in.
Well, that's one of the main drivers of the economy, too, is the availability of energy. It's not so much the cost of energy, because really, generally, worldwide, energy is pretty cheap. Even gasoline is pretty cheap. I know people are saying, no, wait a minute, gas is higher than it's ever been. I know, that's true, but if you were to take a vehicle and haul six of your friends for 1 mile, you're basically doing it for about 20 cents, right? If you were to go to China and tell a rickshaw driver, I want you to take me and five of my friends 1 mile for 20 cents, they'll laugh at you.
All right.
Gasoline is still a pretty inexpensive fuel to be able to move things around the way we move them. But it's dumb. There are better ways of moving around. There are better energy devices. And I would say most of them, the general public knows nothing about.
Absolutely true.
So how is it going to change then? What technology is out there, for one, and how in the world is it ever going to get funded to be able to make it to the marketplace?
Well, the first thing is we're going to have this world government. And properly run, I wouldn't argue against a global government, a fair economy for everyone, and no disparity and all that kind of stuff. But you and I both know that human politicians would not let that happen. They'd be corrupt from the start. But assuming that we could reach the point where we had a global, you know, a world economy like in Star Trek, you know, the Federation and Earth is a, you know, a one system planet. Now, locomotion, you know, trains, locomotives, are historically the most efficient way to transmit loads from point A to point B. Because once you get the stock rolling, the frictional levels are very low, and it's very efficient, you know, energy-wise to get from A to B. They thought that maglev trains, Japan did pioneer some of that, maglev trains would be good and efficient because you'd be floating on magnets and the friction would only be the air, and that would be great. But you got to build these elevated maglev things, and they're expensive to maintain and to build as well. So what is in the back room? Antigravity is not a mystery. It is not, you know, science fiction. It is real. We've had it since the late 60s. I worked on a project where these things were made, you know, flying saucers to work. Now, if you take that technology, which you can set the level of energy in a craft, you know, and these craft can be huge. They can be a mile in diameter. They're not limited because of the way the gravitational fields are set up in it. But they set to an altitude. It's a gravitational potential so that they will follow the gravitational field of potential, let's say 10, and so they will follow it like up and down over invisible mountains and valleys, really, because they will follow that potential once you set up a craft like that. And you can set that into motion just like you can with a locomotive, except this way your energy is in a field that is encapsulated and you don't have a lot of lost energy in the transmission, you know, from point A to point B. That's where it's going. We're going to have, probably limited altitude. You can't let everybody in the world have an anti-gravity craft that can go up, you know, 3 or 4 miles and get into the flight lanes and whatever. And you don't want a drunken driver crashing into your living room that, you know, can't run his anti-gravity car or whatever. There will be restrictions. But as far as mass movements of resources and people or resources, the electrogravitic craft will probably be the most efficient thing we can do next to some sort of teleportation, which I don't hold much hope for.
Yeah, it wouldn't be too far away that we could fax our freight from one side of the country to the other, but I can see where anti-gravity drive would be quite revolutionary, even if you had, you know, a fixed special freeway, as it were, for anti-gravity barges that moved in lanes, you know, from one side of the country to the other, like trains. I never could understand why the darn trains still have the same gauge that a horse and wagon had, you know, in the mid-1800s. Why we didn't make trains, you know, 20 feet wide to the, you know, wheelbase so that you could actually carry some stuff without that thing toppling over.
Well, of course, now then, we've got infrastructure and real estate ownership problems to get that track right away. But, you know, that's an interesting point, though, on track right away. You know, there's a lot of talk on Abraham Lincoln and the assassination in the movies right now. The Union Pacific Railway was guaranteed the lifetime of the company by Abraham Lincoln that they could have unaudited FCC or anybody else, they could have unaudited communication along their track line no matter where it went. So Union Pacific, when Penn Central went bankrupt, they had a little bit to do with that. They bought up Penn Central and its track right of ways because they could then go into any city where they had, you know, track running into it, and they could put digital, you know, electronic money lines along their track and not have to have FCC oversight. Anyway, that's an aside, but it's the issue of the ownership of the track and the track right-of-way that would probably prevent, an efficient conversion to a 12-foot wide or 20-foot wide wheelbase. I get your point, but there's probably some sort of a mathematical optimum width versus, air resistance on the locomotive, versus efficiency on the track that wide and whatever. I don't know, but.
Well, we just need to set the anti-gravity lanes at 200 feet off the ground, and then you don't have to worry about buying up real estate.
Yep. That's the point. That's the beauty of it. And I really expect this to be announced in the next year or two to the public, that the time for holding that information back is just about to pass. It's not without its inherent dangers. Things can go wrong, but basically, it is probably the safest, most efficient way we can get stuff across the planet.
Well, I think since the planet is over almost 5/7 water, the safest way to use the anti-gravity is over water. Why displace the water underneath and roll along at 10 or 12 knots when you could roll along at 60 or 70 knots?
Well, with these things, you can roll along at hundreds of knots. I mean, you're not touching the water.
That's true. In a way, there's real estate to buy. You just have to make sure there's no boats in the way and plot your course, take off.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we're getting to that point, but there's a lot of this technology that's been held back for a long game plan, and we're approaching the end of that long game right now. The Western world, United Kingdom, some of Europe, United States, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, are still kind of, the hierarchy are still fighting the Crusades. And what they've been doing for the last 30, 40 years is trying to use up the Arab oil fields, the Muslim oil fields, to take away the only thing they've got to make money with, to deplete them of that, while we cap off our own oil reserves and gas reserves all over the planet. And there's a lot capped off. A lot. And it's fighting that Crusades is what's driving this at the moment. That's why they want to burn the oil. If they have an Iraqi war, Gulf War II or one, they burn the oil fields over there. Gosh, we'll put them out as quick as we can soon. Well, maybe next week. Well, I sat in meetings with these guys talking about this kind of stuff. It's not idle speculation. The old cotton top guys that drink port and suck on their cigars at lunch, this is the people I was with.
It's amazing that energy and specifically oil, because it's international. Electricity is kind of local. We do import some from Canada, but generally speaking, electricity is good old American made from coast to coast. Oil, however, comes from all over the planet, and the best oil is coming from Saudi Arabia. Some of it's coming from North Dakota now, but it's not all in production yet. And some of that oil is very, very hard to extract. It takes 600 gallons of water to extract one barrel of oil, some of those fields up there. It is.
Yeah, if you're taking shale oil or if you're taking tar sands, it's very expensive.
Yeah, and because gas is so expensive, it definitely makes it worthwhile to do that. But the point is that, as you say, we've gotten to the point where it makes no sense to shovel our planet into our gas tanks and burn it. There are smarter ways. There are better ways. And it has very little to do with saving the planet and lowering the CO2 footprint or, trying to do something environmentally friendly or green. It has to do with something that makes economic sense. It makes energy sense because there are a lot better uses for the molecules that make up oil than to burn it.
Pharmaceuticals, plastics, yes.
Yeah, durable goods, stuff that will last, stuff that we can build, plastic and fibers and inks and dyes and lenses and all kinds of stuff can be made from that, and it just doesn't make any sense to turn it back into its most raw components, CO2 and water.
There are a number of ways to gain energy, convert it into electricity, and the best ways are the ones that don't result in a thermionic or a thermal equilibrium change in the albedo of the planet. Obviously, if you can get something that's not a result of combustion, that's good. If you can get something that's got a constantly renewing and clean footprint, that's really, really good. And if you can get something that you can use off the planet as well, that's even better for space travel and for mining things out in asteroids and on the moon and stuff like that. Now, there are technologies in the back room. There's a thermionic converter that's one, and then there's the thing that's mentioned kind of obtusely in Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, the antenna that draws electricity out of the atmosphere, which is really connecting to the solar wind bombardment, but that's another one. And there are ways to take wind and convert that with high voltage electrostatics, you know, rather than electromagnetic heavy, you know, amperage devices, make low amp high voltage devices. So the three areas, and the one I like the best, which is harder for the average person to play with, is the thermionic thing, because with that, what you do is you trap the transmission of infrared radiation between molecules and atoms, and you, instead of letting it go between the atoms, you trap that. You mine the infrared energy at that frequency and cool the mass while you convert the infrared transmission, which is a normal process of, you know, atomic decay,
sure,
and convert that to electricity.
Right. You don't have to make steam with it. You actually wick the heat off.
Yeah.
In the form of electrons.
Yep, yep. You set up, it's a resonant frequency, and you would probably use dyadic interfaces to rectify it so that once you get a pulse from one group of atoms going this way, then you don't let it go back that way. You trap that impulse into a circuit, like, you know, a Tesla-type tuned circuit, and it doesn't get back into the mix in because the mass is cooled. So using that kind of a concept, you could get in your electric car. You could turn on the rooftop device or the hood or whatever. It sucks the heat out of the air in front of you and on the road in front of you, converts it to electricity, moves your tires. They produce friction on the road and in the air, which leaves a heat signature behind no greater than what you took from it to power it. So the net effect is zero as far as the thermal equilibrium. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And what most people don't know is that 90% of the electricity that's consumed out of the batteries for an electric vehicle is used in acceleration. Once you're at speed, it takes very little energy to maintain that speed.
Which is why the French pioneered the flywheel-type devices in their buses and things to store the energy of braking and acceleration in a flywheel disc so they could reapply it rather than use the fuel to get up to speed.
Right. That came from Formula One. And by the way, what blows my mind is how fast the flywheel turns. It's like 35,000 RPM.
Well, let me tell you about another kind of flywheel. I forgot to mention this. You can take 19 grams or, say, 20 grams of nitrogen gas in a sphere, an enclosed glass sphere, let's say. Put amoebas flipped around the equator of it to conduct the DC pulses. You can inject a radio frequency at 2 million pulses per second and spin that gas and heat it and store energy in the spinning plasma nitrogen gas inside that bubble, that sphere. And then you impress a fixed magnetic field on that to slow it down and extract the electricity out between the poles and the equator where the amoeba strip is. How's that grab you?
So you're talking a permanent magnet to withdraw
yeah.
the energy?
Yeah, you would have that, yeah. All you have to do is impress a magnetic field on a spinning conductor, and you'll get electricity to flow.
Well, if your magnet's powerful enough, if you've got a neodymium magnet, you're going to be limited by your magnetic force.
Well, what you can pull out, yes. And I suppose if you were crafty, you could use some of the energy you've pulled out to strengthen your impressed magnetic field to get more energy out.
Okay.
If you're spinning stuff at 2 million cycles a second or 20 million cycles a second, 20 million RPM is what it would be. That's pretty. You can store enough energy in a little thing about 18 inches in diameter like that to power your car for a month without a refill. But the problem comes if you have a crash and break that containment field. It's a tidy cleanup. It'll leave a hole where you and the car were.
That's true. That's the one thing. Some of these energy devices, they also make pretty handy weapons.
Yeah, sadly. Hopefully we'll reach a time in the future where that's not a problem.
I hope so. Now, you mentioned earlier, and I know you just, maybe it was a Freudian slip, but you said that humans don't do a very good job of managing a one-world government, that politicians would get involved. And you mentioned Star Trek, and I kind of flashed in my mind to this Federation that's not made of just humans. There are, you know, Vulcans on it. There are, you know, wise, long-lived beings from all over the galaxy or all over multiple galaxies that bring their wisdom to bear and create some kind of government or some kind of management system, which isn't a government. It's more of a system of commerce and understanding between people. We have a tendency to take government and turn it into ruling people. It's funny, Obama had a Freudian slip the other day too, or actually a couple years ago, when he said the problem is that I'm the president of the United States and not the emperor of the United States.
Yes, give him time, give him time.
If not him, someone else writes that.
Oh, absolutely. We're headed that way.
That there are off-worlders, do you think that even the Nephilim are involved in, behind the scenes maybe, creating this kind of one-world government that we're seeing unfold before us?
Have you had a chance to look at my book, The Cosmic Conspiracy?
I have, as a matter of fact.
Well, you know then that in there I do discuss that, where I say that it's like from a parallel universe, these beings come to Earth or came to Earth through some kind of a portal, usually up high in the atmosphere, and down to Earth. And they were there, you know, before the Garden of Eden thing. They created, the Elohim created mankind the way we know it today. Now, people call them aliens, and technically speaking, these beings that came from a parallel universe to ours and seeded the planet, whatever, in the Garden of Eden story, seeded the planet with humans like we are, technically they are extraterrestrials because their home is off the Earth. But that doesn't make them little green men from Mars or, you know, the next galaxy over. Not to say that there aren't any out there, but what we're dealing with goes back into the Sumerian records and traces even before that, which tell us about super beings, you know, gods, little g gods, that came to Earth with super technology and bred with our women and made the Nephilim and all this sort of stuff. Now, I think, and I could be wrong, but from the research I've done over the years, I think what we're seeing here on Earth is a virtual courtroom to solve a war, a conflict in the parallel universe in the heavens up there, where the established authority, God, was being challenged to have a dictatorial structure in place of the way he's run the Federation, if you wish. Now, Satan or Lucifer was what the biblical term is for the guy that led the revolution there. Rather than have the warfare there and have collateral damage on property and people and beings, they create the Earth and the environment, and then they try Satan's way here. Try to set up a world government that runs on the dictatorial structure you're talking about and see if it works for you. But if it doesn't, it won't hurt where we are, you know, where they are in the parallel universe, because it's all been done on a virtual war field. Human beings now are even talking about having virtual champions and virtual war to get rid of, you know, collateral damage between countries. Have a game warfare, and whoever wins gets to own the other country. So it's not a stretch of the imagination to say that beings much older than we are that created us have that kind of a structure in place. Now, what I think has happened is that Satan, when he made the challenge and agreed to the virtual courtroom down here, everything started to go the way he wanted it to in the beginning at the Garden of Eden, and things, time passed. And he started to crossbreed. He broke the rules. He and this guy started to crossbreed with our women rather than let the pure race, you know, that God had set up to make the test with, dominate the planet. So this crossbreeding screwed up the virtual courtroom and the fairness of it. So the beings that were hybrids had to all be killed out, you know, at least the majority of them, in the great flood of Noah, and then start over again. And it's a mystery to a lot of people, but after the flood of Noah and all the people and animals that died, the hybrids started to appear again from crossbreedings of the fallen ones, you know, following Satan, who crossbred with our women to produce these beings. Og, the king of Bashan, was in a 1450 or so B.C. He was a giant. His bed was 18 feet long. You know, he either he didn't die in the flood, or he reappeared because of breeding after that. The Greek gods, Heracles and Hercules and stuff like that, these appeared in the Pillars of Heracles, or Hercules, which is probably the Lebanon, anti-Lebanon mountains in the Middle East, where they built the 10 Decapolis cities to honor the gods there in that area rather than over in Greece where everybody thought they were. These things tell us that these beings are real. They have the super technology. It's nothing more than super technology that we're not familiar with. To the ancients, it was magic and, you know, god powers, because it was just beyond their ability to understand. But now we're coming to the end of that. We're coming to the end of the virtual courtroom. And Satan has cheated a number of times in the polluting the whole virtual courtroom environment, trying to make it go his way. So now he has created, in my opinion, gray, short gray cyborgs, biological robots, very brilliant ones, but still soulless, you know, and tall grays. And these have been used to frighten the people of Earth, in all nations, with abductions and cattle mutilations and various, you know, horrific reports that come in, so that people think that this is an alien race that's doing us mischief, so that Satan can come in the last days here with his people who are human-like and probably a little bit taller and, handsome, and maybe their skin might have a slight rainbow sheen to it from small scale-like things in their tissue. But basically they will be like us, and they'll be just like in the V movie. They'll come down. They'll offer us an offer we can't refuse. We'll get rid of the gray critters that have been afflicting you because they don't belong in this part of the universe. They're bad. We've known about them. We'll get rid of those. We'll help you with your economy, set up a world government. We'll set up so that everyone gets to eat and has a job. We'll cure cancer and all kinds of diseases for you. We'll share our technology with you and bring you up to speed over the next, you know, century or two into our way of living, and you can be a member of the Federation of, you know, beings wherever we're from and that kind of stuff. It's a grand deception, and it's going to come to play. It has to come to play when the peoples of Earth, not the governments, the peoples of Earth say, will someone solve the planet for us, get rid of the nuclear war threat, get rid of the politicians, get rid of the Illuminati, get rid of everything that is a threat to us, and give us peace and safety. And this is where Satan comes in, you know, and says, look, we'll help you if you want. All you got to do is agree, and we'll help your man, whoever's in charge of the planet, to run it properly, and you'll see what we're talking about. This, I think, is
what the Bible's. It's interesting, Stan, what we see in, I would say that we'll call it the precursor or the preparatory media that we have of science fiction. The movies, the things that come out, to kind of prepare us for encounters with aliens. And I guess when they first started, it was all E.T., you know, feel good, you know, the grays are good and they're beautiful colors, and now it's all brain-eating aliens, and there's no good about them. However, what I've seen in my travels and as I go out to the various conferences is there are two schools of thought. One is that the aliens are going to come and solve our energy problems, and they're going to, you know, chase all the bad guys again, just like you said. And the other one is that they're going to come here, and it didn't work out so well for the Indians, and it's not going to work out so well for us. I got to tell you, Stan, both sides are very strong in their feelings. Some think that there are Pleiadians and there are Syrians out there, tall, wonderful, you know, godlike beings that are here to help us. And others, you know, are here to secretly work behind the scenes and trade weapons for human DNA. What are your thoughts about that? Are there any good guys out there?
Well, I firmly believe that we were created by the Elohim and God, and that a hybrid being was made that was truly, you know, the unpolluted line of Noah and the Spirit of God, which was Jesus. And I do believe that happened. And those beings are on the side of God, the Creator, and that's two-thirds of them, wherever they are, were not involved in the revolt or the revolution or the challenge to the authority of the established order. They are the good guys, and they are here among us and watching us, the watchers, the good watchers. Now, I have no doubt that they will eventually, in the next probably 10 years, take us into the beginning of the millennial age, where the earth will be healed and things will be done the right way, and we will have a king of the planet, which will be Jesus, Yeshua. And this will usher in the golden age for that millennial period, almost to the end of it, before revolution breaks out again and Satan is loose for a time and his beings that have been chained for that time, to make one last challenge to the authority of God. Now, whether there are beings in other galaxies that, you know, God oversees and has created, you know, I have no problem with that. It doesn't bother me at all. What bothers me is, on our planet, dealing with one posing as God, the God, and is not. He's a fallen one. He was like a federal marshal that oversaw, or he was an overseer of the seat of authority where God was, like the Secret Service is for the president here. And he rebelled. And he's not the president. He's not the creator. You don't want to follow the first lot to come and say we're here to save the world. Sure. This is a great deception. We're warned about it in Matthew 24. The real creator doesn't need TV to say, I'm here. Doesn't need to have you go to some desert location and meet him in a secret place or something. The real creator, when he comes, the sky will light up from east to west, and brilliant, everyone will know in every language, even the animals and the trees will know he's here. It's not some make-believe God, Satan, you know, leading his troops that will be the truth. And that's what we've got to warn people about. Be prepared. Be prepared for this.
So God and the 144,000 are not showing up in silver ships.
Well, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. But when they come, they will they will be the good guys. I don't know how they're going to appear, but yeah.
You want to take some phone calls?
Oh, well, why not?
All right. Let's go with Rob on line one. Rob, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hi, Brooks. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to ask you, the last show I tuned in on was when you were talking with the lady about the truck you have, which is totally off the subject, I know. But are you going to show that truck in Colorado?
Yes, in Boulder, right. We'll be out there in October.
Is that going to happen, October?
You'll have to go to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference website. You can Google that, or you can get to it from my website and find out exactly when the conference is. I think it's going to be October 15th or the weekend right around there. But it'll be a good one. We'll have a lot of energy technologies out there. We'll be out there with the electric truck as well.
Oh, great. Are you still working on the batteries to cool them?
Well, I don't work on the batteries, but I sure buy a lot of them. There's enough battery research going on out there. They'll find us.
Okay, great. And by the way, last statement. I had a guy sign a CD for my friend Nicole, Eric Burden. You ever heard that name?
I don't think I have, no.
One of the band, The Animals, back in the 60s.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, he signed his new CD to her. He signed the old Animals Best Of Bastard for me. But anyway, I'm still in my house. I think that's the best move. In this economy out here in California, houses are really inflated, in my opinion, right now. I think it's a good time to sell out and get what I can.
That's why the inflation's good, because I think there's a bottom below this one.
I believe so, too. That's why I'm going to pull out. I think it's time to grab it. As far as the real estate market goes, and sit back.
Well, I appreciate the call. We'll keep up with the real estate market as well and let you know anything we find and what's coming up. Good luck on that.
Yep.
Thanks very much.
I had a crystal ball. I know what's happened. I don't have a crystal ball. And since the coroner's investigative officer, supervisor can't find my family, and I don't know what to say, you know what I mean? When they can't find them, when nobody can find them, I have to take over the Mexican mafia in my house, there ain't much I can do. So if they can't find them, I sure can. Anyway, I'm going to make the moves possible for financially secure myself. My investment so far,
Good luck. Good luck, and stay in touch. Thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you, Bex. I hope the truck goes well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Randy from Illinois on line three, really quick.
Just a comment. 1927, Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic in an aircraft. Didn't have any fuel. He was using electromagnetic energy to power his aircraft. That's the secret technology that we're looking for. You got a comment there, Mr. Andrew?
You know, I don't know. I thought he made it over to Ford Trimotor. What'd you say, Stan?
I thought the same thing.
I saw the movie with Jimmy Stewart.
No fuel. It was electromagnetic.
Wow.
If you look back at the history, he went with Lester Holdershot, and Lester also talked with Tesla. And he taught him the way to tap into the Earth's energy to power that aircraft. And then it was kind of shut down after that. There you go.
Wow. That's why Charles Lindbergh was an aviation hero and not a statistic.
Correct. They were happy that he crossed in 33 hours from New York to Paris. But and everybody said, well, you know, I would say, how? Well, use the Earth's magnetic field to power up the electric motor to turn the prop.
Interesting.
That's the only way to do it is.
Interesting. So I guess those people that were on the piece going, hey, what's that sound? I guess they weren't really listening to a radial engine on the front of that Ford Trimotor.
who knows? I doubt it, but anyway. Hey, whatever happened to your polar expedition for the inner Earth, hollow Earth thing? Whatever happened to that?
I'm glad you brought that up. Thanks for the call, Randy. Thanks so much.
Have a good night. Thank you.
You too. We are still on. We just did a crowdfunding event unsuccessfully. We tried our hand at it. We do have a larger ship now. We have a application in. We haven't obviously made the deposit on the ship yet, but it carries 124 people besides the 150-man crew. It's 450 feet long, 23,000 tons, 75,000 horsepower. It's fully capable of making the trip. It goes to the North Pole twice each summer, and this trip will be after its last North Pole trip. So, interesting thing about that project, as we have put together the data, put together the studies that have been done that support the idea that planets might form as hollow spheres, we've had some pretty mind-blowing validation. For instance, Dr. Y. Sessions at Washington University did a study with his grad students. They went through 600,000 seismograms. These are, as you know, charts of pressure waves and shear waves from earthquakes that are on one side of the planet that are picked up on the other side of the planet by USGS stations, although the data is not really analyzed. And so that's what he got a grant for and applied his grad students to. And what they discovered was another ocean underneath the Atlantic Ocean. And I thought that was pretty remarkable.
It was. I remember that.
And then Harvard published their paper that said it's highly likely that the core is probably solid and it is probably counter-rotating against the crust. Now, they didn't say it's suspended in an open-air area inside the planet, but it's not this magma jet that they're talking about, how our magnetosphere is created. And that was backed up by a spectrographic study that was done by the Japanese, where they actually picked up the frequencies that were coming off the core, and they determined that it's probably a pure iron crystal, not like a lump of iron, but like a crystal of iron, a complex of iron, and it's probably very dense, upwards of 5 or 6 grams per cubic centimeter. So it's very dense, which would explain why the Earth is in the orbit that it's in around the sun, when it's limited in diameter and surface density. So there are a lot of pieces that have come into place, We're talking to some celebrities to try to get maybe some star power behind the fundraising. But that's where we're stuck, Stan. That's the whole challenge for
us. Well, listen, right now. I hope you get that going, because there are a number of us that agree with you and have visual proof that planets do have they do expand as they age. And with this comes the attendant philosophy or physics that fluid space, you know, ether space in the 19th century vernacular, ether space, you can't see it. It's a very fine structure, but it's spin in that creates atoms and hence, you know, molecules and then, you know, planets and orbits around suns or stars. I'm writing the paper, it's taking me 2 years, I still haven't finished it, on the nature of this, and I draw reference to Neil Adams, the cartoonist, work, where he has, in fact, if you go to my show images link on my site, it's Standale stroke podcast stroke show images underscore between the W and I think I sent that to you earlier before we went on air. But if you go to that, you'll see that he has taken Mars, he's taken Earth, he's taken a couple of moons, Saturn, our moon, and he's taken the satellite images that NASA's provided of their terrain, the whole map, and he has shrunk each one of these objects down to where all of the continental borders, if you wish, of them and main lines of differentiation of the mineral deposits fit together. And in every case, with Mars, with Saturn, with Jupiter, with moons, they have all fit perfectly once you reduce the diameter by at least 25%. Same with Earth. All the continents fit together perfectly if you reduce the size of the Earth 25%, the diameter. Now, arguments against a hollow Earth, as you would probably be aware, are that the mass of the Earth is a known factor relative to everything else in the universe.
Sure.
Therefore, they say, and they assume it's solid, and therefore its core would be made of nickel and iron. But they leave out some of the heavier, more exotic, you know, cesium, iridium type things that could allow a very dense, smaller core with an air gap, or like just an empty gap, an empty shell around that between us and the core. Now, in my the model I've been developing of gravity, you know, the waves, the spin waves in the ether space of the fine structure, it moves mass into concentrated spherical structures, but it, in so doing, it folds over at the poles, it goes inside the planet and reverses its direction at the core, which makes a contra-spinning core, bounces back out. Now, the holes at the polar regions of, like, Mars, you can see where it's frozen over, and I've got pictures of that on that website there I was telling you about. You can see on Saturn where there is a dip going down in the North Pole, like where it could be a cloudy hole. Have you seen that?
Yeah, and it's hexagonal in shape.
Yeah, well, that's another interesting thing that's caused by vortices and spin, but easily understood once you see what's happening. Now, with the Earth and with these other planets and stars, periodically, under the theory of this, the polar regions have to open up slightly, and heat escapes from the core when that happens, and then the holes close again. You see something akin to this when you take a glass of water and you sit it on a mirror so that you've got an image of the glass of water reflected down underneath, you know, in the mirror. Then you put in some iron filings, which are dark, and you put in some sand, very fine white sand, and you stir that glass of water just vigorously until you form a vortex, or like a tornado of air down into the middle of it, spinning everything out to the side of the glass. And you'll see, of course, the iron filings and the sand spinning around madly. But as it starts to slow down, you will see it forms an iron pile in the bottom, followed by a sand pile over the top of that. And if you look in the mirror, that is what's inside of a planet, basically, is the collection of the heavier stuff than the lighter stuff as it slows down. But in the case of planets, when it slows down enough, the shell, the outer shell, opens out and folds out like a three-dimensional splash wave, and becomes a ring, like around the rings of Saturn and Uranus and a couple of the other planets. These rings are leftovers of a shell that's been thrown off, which means you can have multiple voids and multiple cores inside of a mass, like a planet or a star. So when you go up to the North Pole, you will probably be able to notice temperature variations that are abnormal during one of the periods where the holes start to open up. Now, I don't know at this point how wide they would open, but we know that Vostok in the south, in the South Pole of the Antarctic, the Russian base at Vostok, a few miles down, they've got a lake of water. It's at 32 degrees, and it's a liquid lake. That must be being heated up from the South Pole hole opening up. At the North Pole, what's happening? Unprecedented melting of the ice in the sea up there and on Greenland, which, in modern history just hasn't happened. Why is it happening? It's not global warming. I think that what you're trying to prove is correct, that it needs to be done. This model works on all planets.
Well, now you've got to be excited again. We've wanted to quit this 1,000 times, I guess, but we just persevere because, one of my ancestors is kind of involved in this. Sir James Ross is on my grandmother's side. Might be a great uncle or a great great grandfather. He discovered the North Magnetic Pole, but he also discovered the Ross Gull. And this puny little seagull flies north for the winter. It's not built for north. It's not a penguin. It's a seagull. And it apparently nests someplace where it's warm in the winter.
Right.
But no one's been able to track it. I spoke to the world's leading ornithologist on the Ross Gull, and they have never been able to track it north of the 82nd parallel.
Why? What happens?
It's too small of a bird to track. There are no tracking satellites that can pick up a signal.
Ah.
Birds come back in the spring, for summer. The same birds with the bands on it come back, but they can't find them in winter. Nobody's ever sailed up there to see.
I know that NASA has published gravitational potential maps of the planet, and you see, mass cons in certain places and mass deficiencies in other on the Earth. But I'm wondering if they're not showing the variation in the gravitational field, which would be over a very small hole. It's not a big thing. In the North Pole, that if you took a ship up there, if you could measure the gravitational deflection of that off of true, gravity on the rest of the planet, if it might not dip down as you approach the pole. Gravity, not magnetic, gravity.
I was actually talking to a rear admiral, retired, and I asked him about these what are called oceanic depressions, places where sea level isn't really sea level, where the sea kind of dips down permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, these are areas of high gravity. We know all about them. They pull the water down and, we just kind of sail into them and sail out of them. We've measured them lots of times. I said, really? That's interesting. But don't you think it makes more sense that those areas where the ocean is lower is actually where the gravity's less? And the surrounding gravity is pulling it away from that area, and that's why the sea level is lower? And he said, wow.
Gotcha.
That's interesting. We never thought about that. We always assumed it was higher. I said, no, it could be where the crust is very thin right there, and actually you either have a flux hole or an alignment, some kind of parallel alignment or perpendicular alignment to the crust. And maybe a little electrojet action there, lowering the gravitational pull. And it's an area where the gravitational pull is actually less.
Well, so, it makes sense. It's all in perception, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, the thing that frustrated me way back in 2005 when I thought about getting involved with this was, surely somebody's gone. Surely somebody's gone up there and taken these measurements, but they never have. The military's gone, but I don't know what measurements they've taken because, they're painfully short of white papers. They're just not publishing what they found. And it's been flown over, or at least near, a bunch of times, but at high altitudes above the clouds. This is the first time it will have been sailed to, in any scientific way, by sea.
Because this hole opens and closes periodically, just like the stirred water, with the sand and the iron filings from that little cone in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
if you notice, as the water is allowed to slow down, that little funnel in the middle starts to bob as it slows down at the end, up and down, up and down. And I think that's the equivalent of the polar holes opening and closing as it gets close to wind down for, you know, a shell, an outer shell like we've got here.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's just so much about the Earth that needs to be rewritten. You know, the old biblical thing about Noah's flood, and everybody thought it was 40 days and nights of rain, and that's what flooded it. It went on for 110 days, and it was the fountains of the deep, you know, the smokers, that blew up superheated water, and made, the oceans were actually hot when it flooded for Noah. And we found, in 1958, the scientific community found, in IGY, International Geophysics Year, that there was a shell of water just under the surface, just underneath the ocean bottom, just under the mountains. It got thinner under the oceans and deeper under the mountains and land masses. And it's called the Moho-Ravicic discontinuity, or Moho for short. And they found that it was reflecting, you know, seismic waves and things like this. And they were to determine that it's a water shell with about 3.5 times the density of normal water. It's a saline or metal salt water shell. Now, if the core of the Earth expanded, you know, heated up for whatever reason, it expanded, it would press on the surface of the Earth from underneath and make hydraulic vents of superheated water squeeze out of the ocean bottoms. And this layer, this mantle, is between 15 miles and 5 miles thick all over the planet. If you calculate the water volume in there, it is certainly more than enough to flood every doggone mountain in the world. Not worry about 200-foot level rise with the Arctic ice melt and that kind of stuff. We're talking about real tens of thousands of feet worth of water coming up to the surface.
Wow. Well, you know, we've looked at a lot of seismic information, and we've looked at this sort of way they take a CAT scan of the Earth every time there's a big earthquake. But I read your paper on the Romania anomaly, kind of through the planet shield that's being experimented with right now. What is going on there?
Well, you know, I'm saying this is a shield, you know, in the order of Tesla's type of transmitter that he talked about being able to block all aircraft coming in over the United States in the late 30s. He proposed that to the government, using one of his transmitters to set up a tuned broadcast that would emanate from someplace in the United States, go around the planet to the other side, meet itself, bounce back, and it would form a tuned envelope of energy in a harmonic field around the Earth, such that at a certain altitude, any craft moving through that with electrical components, you know, like ignition, the spark ignitions in the engines of those days, it would cause a short and cause the motors to stop. And, of course, if we go to extrapolate that to missiles nowadays, any of the digital electronics on board would be shorted out should they generate current in this standing wave field that they fly through. Now, the reason that I came up with that was purely by kind of accident, because I was doing the earthquake forecast back in January and around the 10th or the 12th, and I noticed a very regular, almost elliptical, donut-looking thermal variation, rapid variation in the sea just east of New Zealand, down the southern hemisphere. I thought, well, that's interesting, and I've put that up on the show images. You can see that if you click on it. You can click the map and see the big image of what I was talking about, the normal one and then the abnormal one. And I looked at it for a couple of days, and I thought, well, I'll put an arrow there and show this is an anomaly. I've never seen anything like it, but, you know, if it persists, we'll at least know it was there. This went on for about 10 days. In the same spot. It didn't move. It wasn't normal weather. It wasn't normal ocean currents. It was a rapid change of temperature around a central point. So I'm thinking, what is there a volcano there I don't know about under the sea? I mean, what is this? Well, then I remembered Tesla and his antipodal antenna structure and all that stuff. The other side of the planet from his transmitter, exactly the other side, the waves would meet, concentrate, and then bounce back to the transmitter on the other side of the planet, and back and forth like that. So I said, what's the exact opposite, the antipodal location of this hotspot in the ocean? And it turned out to be Romania. And I thought, what the heck's in Romania?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So I looked in the news. I went on to Google News, and I looked Romania, you know, and the first thing that came up was missile shield, NATO base, U.S. making a missile shield at Air Force Base at Devoselu in Romania.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was spot on to the intemperate point. Now, this is not supposed to be operational until 2015. But I know from experience, it was down in Stray when they were setting up the Pine Gap transmitter in the early 60s. They flew an airplane around a wire antenna supported by a balloon that held it up. And they flew around for days measuring the field intensity and the reflection of it till they could get the exact spot they needed for a perfect intemperate reflection of it. So if they're doing that now to test it before 2015, then that could explain why we're seeing this come off and on, off and on, as they're testing that field to get the location.
And how are you detecting this temperature anomaly?
Well, I'm detecting both current, you know, electric current changes and temperature anomalies from about three data sources that I use that are not classified. And I put all these together to formulate the map you see, the changes in colors or the changes in the heat transfer due to electron transfer. It's a thermoelectric process in the sea surface. I can only see it there. Now, it's interesting that the Devoselu base in Romania, they're spending $500 million to make a missile shield. And it's a missile shield, little missiles, against Iranian or Middle Eastern missiles coming toward Europe and the NATO alliance. It's certainly not a missile shield to stop Russians attacking the United States, because if a Russian missile launched and got to speed, these guys would have to chase it, overtake it, which is not likely, and then destroy it. So why are the Russians upset about it? Why is it that there are 500 personnel going to be assigned to the Air Force base there? Half of them are Army, half of them are Navy in a landlocked country. The Navy is behind a lot of this communications at Exmouth on the Northwest Cape in Australia and other bases like that in Guam and things like this. So,
I've read a number of stories about this, and we've talked about it briefly on this program, and that is that, you know, the Russians are upset because this kind of tilts the balance of power in Western Europe. Russia, you know, kind of holds the same old Cold War, you know, mutually assured destruction kind of attitude, which is, look, we've got missiles pointed at you, you have missiles pointed at us, and that's how we keep each other honest. But you put the shield in, and now we can no longer point our missiles at you. We're saying, no, this doesn't have anything to do with you. We're trying to stop a rogue missile out of North Korea or Iran or Pakistan or something like that coming over here to the United States or to Western Europe. The question is, and one of my listeners just sent this to me, why was it not supposed to go operational until 2015? What's so special about that year?
Well, I guess it's how long they think it'll take to build all the support structure there for the troops that are coming in. At least that's what they say in the news articles. And if you look up Missile Shield Devoselu, Romania, you'll get a lot of the story. And a lot of the story I've reproduced there on the website about this. But I get back to the issue about why are the Russians so upset about this, when if Russia wants to launch missiles at the United States from, say, the Siberian side, they can get across the ocean there without being picked off by the missiles at Romania, because the missiles that are supposed to be interceptor missiles would have to travel so fast that they overtake a supersonic missile that's already left. They got to chase it. They're not meeting it head on like the old days where you could track the ICBMs coming your way and you could meet them head on and you could, you know, blow them up, you know, theoretically. These would have to not only detect them, but chase them, overtake them, and that is like twice the speed of what they're doing already in Russia. That doesn't make sense. And if they're trying to attack the United States from the European side, they're still going to have to chase it. It doesn't matter. Whichever way Russia goes to attack, the missiles themselves wouldn't be enough. But the Woodpecker signal that came out of Russia at Riga years ago tells you that they were playing with the same thing that was done at Pine Gap and at Exmouth. So they know about that. And if that kind of a shield is erected, then their missiles would have very little effect, because they wouldn't get very far, because this field is around the entire planet at a fixed altitude. And only things traveling, you know, at a certain speed and above would short out. And no matter how hardened they make them, they would short out.
One of the things that has me concerned about this is, you know, we got HAARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, which is basically a high-frequency weapon system. And there are multiple phased arrays like this around the planet. You mentioned the woodpecker, and I mentioned HARP on the North Slope of Alaska, and there are others. One is bad enough. You're pouring all this energy up into the ionosphere and pushing it around, making, you know, parabolic reflecting surfaces and bouncing ELF and ULF waves off of it and having psychotronic effects on living things and EMP effects on electronic things. But when you turn multiple ones of these on, can the ionosphere really take it?
Well, when you turn multiple ones up and on, say like at least eight that we know about, and they're run by different governments with different objectives, how do you coordinate the effects that their fields are going to have on each other? You know, the interference patterns that will form in the ionosphere. To me, that's a problem.
How would you predict? You're going to get, you know, sort of like throwing two ponds into a stream or into a two rocks into a pond. The waves are going to come together and they're going to interfere with one another in unpredictable ways because, for one thing, the ionosphere is unpredictable anyway. Just ask Mr. Marconi. You get multiple ones of these things. Who's to say that the ionosphere is not going to have an allergic reaction?
Well, who's to say that the strange bird deaths where they seem like they've been hit by a solid wall over the southern United States, or booms that where there's nothing there to make a boom in the sky, or the moans that we're hearing of the planet, are they a result of this, the beat frequency, the interference between these different transmitters? I mean, you know, that could happen.
But Fox News told me it was from bottle rockets.
Oh, I believe that. I got a bridge in the desert. I want to sell you great stuff.
That we have an experimental side of the military, whether it's U.S. or whether it's some multinational force that we don't really understand. We call it Black Ops. That is playing with radio weapons. And they really don't know the ramifications or the long-term effects, or for that matter, short-term effects on the planet, any more than we did the first time they pushed the button on a hydrogen bomb.
You know, our science is all very linear. It's like post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means it has happened this way before, therefore it will continue to happen this way in the future. Disregarding, of course, changes in the sun, the Earth's diameter, magnetic field. You know, these are things that we can't predict, but we don't worry about them when we go on what has gone before. And this is rather shaky scientific logic.
Well, it is when you consider that we're right in the middle of solar cycle 2013 or 24, which is not behaving itself at all, not like solar cycles we've seen in the past. We now are watching magnetic filaments that we've never been able to see before. We have multiple sunspot clusters working on the sun, which are interacting with galactic waves, which we've never been able to detect before. And all of these variables are crashing in upon our atmosphere at the same time that we're experimenting with these missile shields and psychotronic weapons. It just sounds like a recipe for disaster with a capital D.
Oh, it is indeed. And the only kind of logical way to mitigate this to a degree would be to have a global control over all this kind of transmission so that they're at least monitored and working in harmony or in concert with each other to change the weather, to grow crops or something. But this just isn't going to happen. And as you say, solar sunspot cycle 24 is such an anomaly that even NASA has said it's the grand solar sunspot cycle, even though the solar sunspot count is lower than normal. It is the grand solar maximum that has never happened before. And why? Like you're saying, the filaments, the magnetic field disruptions, the coronal holes, and we're about to see the North and South Pole flip on the sun, which it does, you know, every 11 years. But at the same time that all this stuff is going on, we've burned over half the hydrogen fuel out of the sun, and it's potentially can go to a helium-helium reaction. And, you know, there are too many variables to play with the stuff we're playing with.
Well, that and now take into consideration that our own magnetic pole is racing at about 25 miles a year straight for the Siberian flats.
And that's twice as fast as the South Pole is moving, so it's an asymmetric wobble.
Oh, that's really wild. Now, when you were in Australia, you were working, I believe it was with Dr. Teller.
Yeah, in the early part, yeah.
On black operations or dark operations, things that were off budget. And, you know, my conversations with you over the years have been both enlightening and stimulating because you have this dichotomy about you. On the one hand, you have a high level of technical training and technical experience. But somewhere in there, you had a kind of spiritual experience that changed you and brought that technology idea into the realm where it is now. You want to talk a little bit about that experience and how you came from the Teller days to where you are now?
Well, actually, it kind of started before the Teller days. It was in the before I left to go down there. It was about 2 years before I got contacted, and it was in 69. And I had contracted some kind of a bacterial infection that was just so painful that I could only lay in bed and stretch my arms out, my legs, and try to minimize the pain. And so I'd gone to the doctor that day in the hospital there, and I said, look, there's something wrong here. And they said, yeah, well, look, we're trying this new antibiotic. It was called Acromycin 4 at the time. And, you know, we'll do a dose on you and see what happens. And so they gave me a shot, and then they gave me some tablets and said, all right, now go home. If this doesn't start to reverse, you know, by tomorrow in the afternoon, well, you better come on in and let us check in and do a full workup. I said, fine. So I went back to my flat apartment. It's a flat in Aussie speak. But anyway, went back to my apartment. I was laying in the bed in my bedroom trying to move my body out, you know, the arms straight out the side, the feet kind of, you know, straight down. And I realized that it's kind of like what you'd be if you were hanging on a cross. But anyway, that was the position that it hurt the least. But I still hurt so bad I just couldn't believe it. And then something started to happen. I had, you know, a near-death experience. And as I was looking up at the ceiling in the bedroom, I noticed that there was a darkness closing in, and the light in the ceiling was a diminishing little circle of light until it was gone. And it was dark. And I heard sounds out in the pool, you know, in the apartment building. There were people swimming and laughing out there. And then I heard, well, someone's turning the volume down on all sound, not just them. I can't hear anything. It's quiet. Now I'm mystified. And I realize that I'm starting to ease out of my body and float up and look at my navel. And then, like, I saw something like a drop of water falling toward my navel, and I was intrigued by watching it in slow motion. And bang, all of a sudden, I was shooting out my body straight up through the roof and out into a smooth, silky darkness. And just wonderful feeling. It was a tremendous speed. But I couldn't reference the speed in that I could see, just what I could feel, like a fluid was flowing through my body. And I saw, out to the right side of me and traveling out toward that light out there, I saw little TV screens, or like stages, but they were like TV screens, of all kinds of events that I had been involved with the people in my life before, where I had hurt them by saying or doing or not saying or doing something, and I got to see how it affected them after we parted ways. And, you know, I was kind of being like an impartial judge of myself. I wasn't embarrassed. I said, yeah, that's right, I did that. I see how I hurt them. And as this was happening, and I was flowing through that fluid, and the TV screens were flowing with me off to the right, I would feel something break loose from my body and wash away in the stream. And I'd look back, and I'd see something like a dust cloud of mud that left my body as though it were made of screen wire and just poof, gone. And at that moment, I would lose a negative emotion like hate or greed or fear. It would leave me. And I felt cleaner and lighter. And pretty soon, the TV screens shut down one by one. Now, I was watching nearly 100 of these at the same instant. It wasn't like, I'll look at this and then I'll look at that one. My mind expanded to where I was seeing them all at once. And I got to ask a question or two about how the universe worked, and I got to see how everything worked. I understood it out there, but when I came back into my body, it was a little bit different, but I couldn't. But anyway, all this was quite intriguing, and I curled up to rest because of the incredible peace that I was feeling. And as I did, something caught my right side of my body and jerked me around like a rope, pulling me back down into my body. And I couldn't stop it. And I fell down toward the body, and I thought, well, I'll hit the body with my right arm and my right leg, I'll cut whatever is that rope that's pulling me back, and then I can get back out of here, because I didn't want to come back. And I had a left leg on a kind of a smooth ledge and my right arm over that ledge holding me there while I tried to figure out how to work my body again to stop whatever pulled me back. And I realized, as sound started to return, that it was a phone ringing by the bed. So I had to figure out how to move my arm like a 10-pound ham holding it on one end, trying to reach over the phone. I managed to knock the phone off and onto the bed. And I heard my mother's voice calling my name and saying, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And I couldn't answer for a minute because my mouth was dry and throat was dry, and I had to get it all working again to speak. So I said, "No, I'm fine, Mom. Sorry, why did you ring?" "Well, you know, when your grandfather passed, he walked in front of me. Same thing, you just passed in front of me." I said, "No, I'm fine. You're going back to sleep." And I'm thinking, I'll get her off the phone. I'll get back out there. Well, in that moment, my left arm and left leg slipped off the ledge, and I was trapped back in my body. And strangely enough, no pain at all. Now, I get up and I'm thinking, wow, that's just incredible. Great medicine, I guess. Well, so I went to an all-night cafe there in Dallas, and it was getting closer to morning, and I said to the waitress, I said, "Look, could I order some, pancakes and eggs and stuff?" She said, "Sure." And she puts a napkin down, and I had a ballpoint in my pocket, and I kind of doodled on the napkin while she was going to fix my breakfast. And when she came back, she says, "Oh, that's nice. What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's a picture of the Earth if you're out in space looking at it. And this saucer is coming like that. And it's the Creation Conquest." She said, "What's that?" And I said, "I think it's a book I'm going to write." Now, if you knew me, that was the furthest thing ever in my life of wanting to be. I astounded myself, and she said, "Oh, well, I'd like to read it." I said, "Oh, yeah, so would I, yeah." Okay, that was in 69. It was 2 years later before Teller's Group contacted me and knew what I was doing in my private research and anti-gravity and whatever, and recruited me to go to their facility in Australia. Now, when we parted ways in Australia, it was a traumatic parting, like almost, they were going to put me at the bottom of a mine shaft because I didn't like what they were keeping back from the public, and I didn't understand, and I wanted to release it to the public, some of the technologies. Well, I ran from them. It took me, I was across Australia. It took 6 months to get across. I went through the Great Nullarbor Desert with some people. And one night, just the other side of Adelaide, we'd been in the town about two nights before. We were gone west of there into the desert. And I was sitting in the car headlights reading a little Bible, and a page had been turned down and given to me by a little old white-haired lady in a black dress in Adelaide, because I'd been attended a UFO meeting as a guest of somebody there. And she'd heard me talking about, the digital money system and things that I'd worked on back in Dallas. And she says, "You'll be very interested in what's in this little book here. I know you don't have time now. I've marked a page. Read it when you get a chance." So two nights later, there I am in the middle of the desert. And thinking, I wonder how long it's going to be before they catch up with me and kill me. The guys are pretty intent that I don't tell everybody what we're doing. Well, Revelation 13, mark of the beast, money, right hand, forehead. We had gone through all this back in Dallas when I was advising some of the Union Pacific guys about, how we could set up a cashless society, use the track right-of-ways and stuff, and we could go digital and, eliminate a lot of crime and stuff like that. And we had worked out why it had to be the right hand and why it had to be the forehead if they didn't have hands and if they wore a burqa veil, all this kind of stuff we went through. And we located the positions on the body that this barcode could be put. And it turned out to be the exact same thing that she showed me in the Revelation 13 of the Bible. Well, I looked up into the night sky there, beautiful there in the desert, and I said, I believe this now. And, I think I might be meeting you pretty soon, sooner than I expected, because they're on my tail, and huh? I just want to be sure we're on the same side. And man, I'm with you. I understand now. Then, and I'm, I give you permission to enter my life and go from here. Well, it was 2 days later that miracles started to happen, and they didn't stop for many years. In fact, they haven't stopped. They still keep going. But I was shown in no uncertain terms and told the Lord was looking after me from that moment forward, and that's kind of how I mixed my science with the philosophy. I didn't die. The Lord kept me around for another 40 years. So,
and we're all a beneficiary of that that event, because, it's hard to find people that have had a spiritual experience to go back and get a worthwhile technical experience, because it's kind of, you know, they're not willing to learn the dark side because they've already been, you know, inspired by the spirit. But you have those that have been trained, like, you know, those of us that come up through science, we learn the scientific method, we learn to rely on facts and data and provable things and sort of a geometric way of laying things out in a logic pattern so that you can make your case. That's the antithesis of the spiritual experience. The spiritual experience is a raw communication with truth and purity. And it is something for which you have no measurement system. It's something for which you have no gauge, no, you know, it's just pure observation. And to be able to resolve both of those, to be able to say, I can have a spiritual experience and still be a scientist. I can still believe in God, and I can still be like Jesus because I have this scientific knowledge, not in spite of it.
Absolutely. Hey, remember when he walked on the water in the Sea of Galilee?
Yes.
Okay. Think about this. If you're in your motorboat, hurling along over the surface of the lake somewhere, and you put your hand out into the water, say you're going about 30 knots or something, that water's hard, isn't it?
Sure. It's pretty easy to stay afloat if you angle your foot just right.
That's right. You can slalom, or you can water ski behind the boat lightweight, because everything is hard. Now, you don't have to move through the water like that. If you vibrate your atoms back and forth fast enough, the water will seem like it's solid, won't it?
Sure.
And so Jesus walks out, and his vibrational rate has changed. He's faster than the water, and he can walk just like it's solid, because it's like, you know, walking on sand. He walks out, and he says, was it Peter in the boat that he called to come out to him?
Right.
Okay. So he comes out, and he says, come on, it's all right, just have faith. And I don't know whether that meant that, you know, he had to let the spirit vibrate him or what, but he starts to walk out and realizes, I'm underwater, I can't be underwater. He starts to sink. So the Lord touches him with his hand, and immediately he's pulled up, and Jesus gets on the boat with him, and suddenly they're back at the shore that quick, like teleported. And that's another thing, too. When Philip was teleported up the coast to talk to the eunuch, he wasn't like traveling on a train or anything else. He was suddenly here and then not here and then with the eunuch there. And that's like Star Trek, teleporting. So the Holy Spirit has technology behind it that I think is absolutely just super, you know. I can't wait.
Well, when you think about the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up, and he temporarily speeds them up to a point of transfiguration where they're able to withstand the vibration or the frequency that they're going to be exposed to.
Yeah.
And, of course, they see, you know, these holy beings. And the first thing Peter wants to do is, well, let's build a temple for each one of these. He's to be earthly about it. And Jesus, you know, basically is saying, look, that's very nice, but look, it isn't about that. Here, what I want you to see is that there's a whole other thing besides what we're going through here in the dust and dryness of the Middle East. And what a lot of Christians, modern Christians, both Protestants and Catholics, don't pay any attention to is where Jesus was and what he was doing from the time Mary and Joseph took him from Bethlehem to Egypt and the time he came walking back into Jordan to meet with John. That's a number of years in which he was either learning higher Eastern ways or he was refining his skills with Eastern masters.
Well, I don't know whether it was that or whether it was just direct revelation of the Spirit. I mean, it could be either way, but he certainly does have that. We'd have that blank in his history.
Yeah. Well, but when you go to Tibet and you go to these Eastern places, you see his influence in those places. You see this bearded, you know.
Oh, do you?
From the West that comes there and shares time with him, and they learn from him.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't put that together, but I believe that it's complete mastery over the physics of this planet, one of the extra biblical books about the Transfiguration said that the disciples were staying there, and as he rose up to join Moses and Elijah, lightning sparks came underneath his feet to the earth as he rose up. And I wonder if that wasn't why he told Mary in the garden, just as he came out of the tomb, "Don't touch me, I'm not yet ascended." Something was changed, you know, had to change in his energy levels, or it would drain it or hurt her or something. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no question about that. And I, what I find, and this is one of the most touching things I ever considered about the scriptures, is that of all the people that he could have appeared to first, he chose Mary. Not the apostles, not even his favorite, but Mary.
Yeah.
And then she didn't recognize him. He had to speak to her before she recognized him.
Yeah. How about him walking through or appearing through a solid closed locked door to the disciples? You know, it's just, I mean, these are technologies that we're now aware, you know, dimly of how to do them, you know, polarizing mass and letting one mass pass through another. But he just, with the power of thought, just walked through a solid wall.
Sure.
I find that amazing. Brooks, can we take about a 3-minute break? I just need to get a drink.
I can tell your voice. I'll tell you what, let me play about 5 minutes of music, and we'll take a 5-minute break. We'll be right back with more Stan Deo. Don't forget his website, standeo.com, and be sure to check out Stan's Corner on there. We'll be right back with more X-Squared Radio right after this.
Thank you.
back to X-Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 27 degrees and clear. If you go out and look, you'll see planets near the moon tonight. My guest is Stan Deo. His website, standeo.com. Be sure to check it out. So glad you could be here with us tonight. And hopefully Stan's got something to wet his whistle, and we're back on the air. How are you, Stan?
I'm good. I'm hoping it's going to take effect, a little bit of lemon and honey.
Well, if your voice wears out, you know, we can lay off any time. I'm just having so much fun with you.
It is fun, isn't it? I wish we lived next door. We could have some really stimulating discussions.
I know it, because, you know, one of the advantages you have over me is that you speak Hebrew, do you not?
Well, poorly, but I translate pretty good. You have to kind of live in the environment where you're speaking the Hebrew to be proficient at it, but I got good enough that I could read the street signs in Israel and, you know, ask for what I wanted and usually be understood. But my forte really is in very slowly, painstakingly translating the Hebrew bit by bit of a word, and not just a Strong's Concordance thing, but the actual bits of the word, taking it apart and rebuilding the word.
Well, see, I'm handicapped because I was raised on the King James Version, and I've digested a couple of other versions other than that. But frankly, the translations and the, shall I say, anglicization of the wording changes the meaning so much, I don't have any trust of the translations anymore. I don't even know if the King James Version was telling me the truth on some of this stuff. So, but you're going directly to the source, or at least as far back as you can with respect to the manuscripts. What are the main things that you're seeing that I'm going to call it the Christian world has wrong about our relationship with God, who we are, why we're here, what the purpose of this earth life is?
Well, I guess one of the main things that stands out, and it's not wrong, it's just misinformed, is that we're going to go sit on clouds and play harps, in the world to come. It's a technological world that is going to be quite beautiful.
Well, I'm glad, because I really cannot play the harp.
No, definitely not. And I tend to fall through clouds. But anyway, seriously, the King James Version is what I use for, you know, basic discussions with people and lectures and things. But the problem is, when you change from any language to another, it's usually going to take more words in the language you're translating to give the proper cultural, ethnic bias, colloquial meanings to phrases that the other language uses, and it might even be an outdated language, you know, or an old language like Hebrew. So what I wanted to do was to get back and look at the original, the oldest, the Hebrew, rather than the Greek. I wanted to go to the Hebrew, which was the oldest document, and I wanted to see for myself what it said, because that way I could be sure that I wasn't having someone with a prejudicial viewpoint translating and let me see what they wanted me to see in the translation. Now, in so doing, I found out that from the rabbis I studied with that if they were to translate, in fact, this has been done to a degree in the commentaries on the Torah. If you try to translate that to English in the modern, you know, American English community and England as well, what happens is you end up with about 35 times the volume of words in the English translation to try to adequately explain all the nuances of the original Hebrew, if you weren't raised that way. Now, I started figuring out how to translate by, you know, I took a short self-teach course from Behrman House in New York by mail order, and it allowed me to, you know the alphabet and be able to pronounce words and sight recognition, you know, words and basic speak and all that. But it also allowed me to take a Hebrew, Chaldean, and Aramaic lexicon, which is a thick book that has all the translations, all the adverbs, all the adjectives, all the nouns, all the related things in the various languages, broken out down to the gnat's eyelash within a word, not just a word. So I could build words up with that. So I started using that to painstakingly go through and take parts of the Old Testament, to the Torah, and translate phrases and things that were difficult to see what they really meant, to see what the cultural bias was. Mm-hmm. And I learned so many things that, you know, I, like, for instance, the name Melchizedek, it's it's Melchizedek. It's two words, but they call him Melchizedek in English. Well, I found out that his name, when you broke it apart, stood for the first part of it for 40, 30, 20, 10, which was like the time of the testing, the 40 years, the Messiah's age at maturity, the witness and the perfect unity, all this. And the second half of the word was to adorn oneself with the spoils of plunder, and that's just what Melchizedek did, Abraham did it for him, but it was all the story and the path of the Messiah in one name. And I thought, wow, this is neat. Well, my accountant was Jewish there in Perth when I was doing this, and I told Richard about this, and he says, you ought to come talk to my rabbi. He's from the States, but he's down here, and he'd be interested in what you're saying. I said, well, okay, fine. So the time came, and Richard picked me up, and he said, look, we'll eat lunch first. We'll go over here to, the Pizza Hut and get a pizza. I said, pizza? The rabbi, I think that's kind of – he said, oh, you mean bacon breath? No, he won't worry about that. It's okay. Okay, fine. So we go over, and he says, now stay in the car, and I've told the rabbi we're coming to his home, and I'll just go down and tell him we're here. And he's a little sensitive about these things, dealing with, Jesus and that kind of stuff. So I'll just go down and tell him we're here. So I watch through the car window. He goes down and knocks on the door. And he knocks on the door. He goes and looks in the window. There's no answer. He goes and knocks on the door. Pretty soon, the door cracks open about an inch, and a nose and an eye looks through it. And there's a nodding of head. There's a pointing back at me and hands in the air and this and that. So Richard comes back and says, okay, we can go in now, but you can't mention, the name of Jesus under his roof anywhere, or the roof will fall in and lightning will strike us dead. Okay, fine. He says, his family's all been locked up in the back of the house so that you can't pollute them with your presence. I said, okay, fine. Okay. And he says, now, this is a scribe, rabbi. He actually handwrites the scrolls for the shul, for the temple, or for the synagogue. And, this is a very exacting science. And he was trained in physics and whatever else. I said, okay, good, fine. So we go in, and, he stands back, and I sit on the couch in his front room, which is all shut up. And he says, okay, Richard was telling me that you found some interesting way to translate the Hebrew or something like that. And how can I help you? I said, well, look, just one thing here. In the name of Melchizedek, I found this by translating it, and I told him a little bit about it. He says, where did you get your Hebrew version of this? I said, oh, I got a Green's version. It's from the Torah written in Hebrew. He said, oh, no, look, I'm a scribe. I write the scrolls. It's not Melchizedek. It's Melchizedek. Oh, sorry, Rabbi, I didn't realize that. He said, yeah, let me show you. I've written this many times. He takes out the scrolls, and he rolls them out, the Torah scrolls for the synagogue, and he gets his little pointer pencil, and he's reading through it, and what? And he dances on one foot, then the other. His face gets red. He grabs his head with his hand. He dances around. Oh, you will forgive me. And I'm thinking, what did I say? I'm thinking that he's putting a chant or something because, what? And he says, let me show you. He says, I have written this name so many times, I can't tell you. And I just saw it as Melchizedek, which means King Sedek. But it's not Melchizedek. It's Melchizedek. And the K is reversed. And he said, I apologize. He says, tell me more how you did that. And so I told him. And now this time my accountant Richard sitting over in the chair being very quiet. And his eyes are big like saucers. He's been watching a real show. So the rabbi and I talk, and I show him some other things. He says, I'd say 85% of the time, the way you're doing that will get right to the nitty-gritty of the Hebrew. Maybe 15% of the time you make a mistake doing it this way. But, hey, you're telling me stuff that we only sing in the yeshiva. We never write it down. Let me show you something. And so then he showed me another little thing about the covering with the wings of eagles and how it translates in the Song of Moses. And there's another code there. And I thought, wow. And he introduced me to the skip code. Anyway. He says, you know what? You need to see. I'll tell you what. And he starts grabbing volumes of books and color pictures of the Ark of the Covenant, things that, I'd never get my hands on. And he loaded them into a box. He says, these are my precious books. Take them and study them. Bring them back when you're through. Now my accountant, Richard, he's nearly falling off the chair because not only is he.
Oh, right, right.
Right. So that started a two-year fun time. And we studied many times, and I came to find out that he's a closet Christian, a messianic believer, and has a New Testament in Hebrew in his home. And before he left, the last day before he left the country to go back to the States, it was a Sunday, and he called me into the synagogue, and he into the back room of the kitchen, and we had coffee, and I asked him some more questions, some things I wanted to clear up about the translations, and he said, "Now, okay, have I answered all your questions?" I said, "Oh, yes, sorry, I didn't realize it got so late." He said, No. Let me get you another cup of coffee." And he went over himself and served me coffee in kosher cups and everything, came back. And he leaned over across the table at me. He says, "Now, I have been your rabbi, your teacher on these things for, you know, a couple of years now. Will you be my rabbi on the New Testament and prophecy?" Well, the hairs on the back of my neck stood straight out like twang. I'm thinking, holy cow. So, yeah, we had a great discussion. What are you saying?
I said, no pun intended.
Yeah. it was marvelous, and the technique, as I say, is slow, but I do get to the bottom of things, and it allowed me to share, or him to share with me, many other rabbinic secrets, which are not for the general, you know, population to really delve in. And this skip code that, you know, the Drazen code or whatever, this is not right. It's not right.
Yeah, I get a feeling that, you know, the posthumously using numerology to say, "Oh, see, it was written here diagonally," you know, in the scriptures, the way they line up. But I don't have a lot of faith in it, or at least a lot of confidence in it. I'll use that word. It's a better word, because the future events don't lay out the way they're supposed to. It's easy to go back into past events and, "Oh, say here's 9/11, you know, here's Obama, here's this, here's that." But yeah, No one saw it beforehand. You have to go back and find it in the code.
There now, is a skip code there, though. The rabbi showed me, like, every book of the Torah has the signature of the person involved. Like, for the Torah, or the book involved, the Bereshit, the first word in Genesis, Bereshit bara Elohim ha'eretz b'ha'eretz Hashem, etc., etc. Okay, the T at the end of Bereshit is the T for Torah. You count 49 letters, then you get the O. 49 letters, you get the R. 49 letters, you get the Hey. And there are codes like that that are there. But not, as you say, after the fact does not count. And if I tell you about alien UFOs, satanic invasion, a grand deception, if I wait until that happens and they're in the skies and they're talking to people and I say, "Oh, it's a trick, don't believe it, it's a bad guy, really," that's after the fact, and it's sour grapes. It has to be done before the fact, and in that respect as well. So
Exactly. Now you mentioned Melchizedek, and that's the way I've always said it. I don't even think I could remember how to say it the new way, but you know, for a long time, I doubted that he was even a real person. I thought it was more of a concept. But I believe that he probably was a real person, and that he was, you know, Immaculate Conception, similar to Jesus, because an angel moved upon, you know, Noah's brother's wife, and she conceived while he was at the temple, which... they're celibate, by the way, while they're at the temple. And so she couldn't have got pregnant from him, which made him mad because he thought that she'd committed adultery. And so he told her, "Get out of my sight before I strike you and defile myself." But the
Wait a minute. This is Noah, you say?
No. It was
Joseph.
It was Mir. Mir's wife. And I can't remember her name now, but she's the one that bore Melchizedek and died shortly after childbirth. And then the angel, I believe it was Gabriel, came and said, "We're going to take Melchizedek with us while you all go through the flood, and then we'll bring him back after the flood, and he'll take care of the bones of Adam and Eve." But he later became the king of Salem, which is Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, you know, the priest that Abraham went and paid his tithes to. So he's a very, very, you know, high up high priest.
And a real being.
Yeah, I believe so. And the interesting thing is, in Hebrews chapter 5, we see him mentioned while Jesus is in the desert. And at least the way the King James Version alludes to it, it looks like Melchizedek comes back and gives the Melchizedek priesthood to Jesus while he's in the desert.
Well, it does say that Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek, so yeah.
And it uses the same phrase, the power of an endless life, which was the description of Melchizedek's birth. So that, at least that's the English translation.
Yep,
and
yep.
As I said, I have doubts in it. I'd love to read the Hebrew and see if Melchizedek really did come back as some resurrected being or translated being to physically lay hands on Jesus and give him the Melchizedek priesthood. That would be fascinating.
It would be, and it's in keeping with the way that the, like in the Pentecost, that the flame descended and they laid hands on people to pass the spirit from body to body.
Right.
It's in keeping with the way it's done there.
So interesting. So, you know, we have this training, you know, 30 years as a Sunday school teacher, you don't forget stuff, and you see a lot of miracles, just plain miracles, and nothing else can describe it. Healings and conversions and life changes that are so radical, it's like something external had to, I mean, not a near-death experience, literally a mighty change of heart in a person that you would never think it would happen with.
Right, right.
And we've seen it. We've seen generations do it. We've also, unfortunately, seen tremendous warfare because of differences in religious belief. We're seeing it now. Where do you see this going in the next, let's say, 20 years? We got Obama as president. We have a lot of prophecies being fulfilled as we speak. We have popes leaving office before they die. We have all kinds of special things that are occurring all at once. Where do you see us going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, you said 20 to start with. 5 to 10 I'll deal with. The Middle East situation around Israel is the timepiece we've got to watch. And the situation is so grave, so perilous for this year, and in the next 2 or 3 months even, for Israel to be attacked by Iran or by factions of the terrorists in Damascus or in Syria somewhere, is so grave that Israel is going to have to make some sort of a preemptive strike, whether it be electromagnetic, you know, EMP type thing, or whether it be electronic warfare, whether it be a physical attack on one of the nuclear facilities there in Iran. They're going to have to do something to protect themselves because they cannot afford to let a nuclear device or a biological missile be launched from Syria since it's so close to the northern borders of Israel. There wouldn't be time enough to get something in the air to stop it properly, especially if they had several of them coming at you at once. Iron Dome can only do so many, and you're out of shots. Now, if Israel doesn't do anything, and the world powers, the powers that be, do something to Iran or Damascus and blame it on a Jewish thing, then the same thing happens. Israel is a target of world hate. This is all going to have to come to play this year, and I think in the next 2 or 3 months. When that happens, as it happens, or just before it happens with Israel, the world is going to be hating the Jews and blaming them for the world's problem, and Russia will be called in by treaty arrangements with Syria and Iran, and neighboring countries, Muslim countries, to defend them against Israel and the United States. Russia knows this already. Russia will do everything it can to be sure that our listening posts at Guam and in Pine Gap and whatever are disabled, that we have internal strife so bad that we couldn't dare help the Israelis if Russia moves in to honor its treaty with the neighboring countries. So I think that the United States, before the end of this year, before the next, you know, before the summer, is very likely to see civil disobedience, martial law, an economic collapse. I mean, several things happening all at once, which will make us so busy with our own problems at home that we will not be a force to be reckoned with when Russia invades Israel.
I could agree more. And the speed with which it's going to happen, and it's not as though we didn't try. I think that the whole Benghazi thing was a brokering event, trying to get weaponry in the hands of rebels in Syria. Russia didn't want it to happen. They moved mercenaries in a couple of weeks before. They went after Chris Stevens and his staff, and wiped them out and took the missiles. They never made it to the rebels. The Russians couldn't allow that to happen. They're going to support Syria and the Sunni that control the Shia there. And really, that's just a battle against Saudi Arabia, the Shia that are in Saudi Arabia. They want Syria to be free, finally, after all these centuries. But in the meantime, you got Hezbollah, which is, in the Palestinian neighborhood, and that's really the only group that the Israelis really fear, because they have no technology. They know that they're trying to smuggle in whatever they can launch out of a spider hole in the ground over the fence at Israel, and they don't care what happens to them. They've long since stopped caring. And then you got Putin buying up 564 metric tons of gold this week. He knows what's going to happen. He's hedging his bets. We're seeing the stage set up just like we're getting ready for a Super Bowl game. I can see it.
Yeah, and it's so quick, as you said. I mean, just the last 5 years have just been astounding, the things, the changes that have been happening.
And it seems, I mean, if you and I can see it, surely Obama can see it, and his staff can see it, although I really question, I have great faith in the ineptitude of his staff. I've never seen anybody so afraid to hire or appoint someone smarter than him in my life. But that's what I see in his organization. I don't see a competent staff. I see a unilateral staff that operates off executive orders, and I don't even know where his orders come from.
Well, it's on the golf course somewhere.
Well, I think Valerie Jarrett is some key to it. She's Iranian-born and connected very highly with the Iranian government.
This Middle East talk and the atom bomb and stuff talk about Israel just triggered something in my memory. When I was studying, retranslating those portions of the book of Daniel about the Antichrist of this age, one of the things that he does is to cause the abomination which makes desolate to be placed in the temple in Jerusalem. And it warns the people of Jerusalem, get out of town, don't go for your bag or anything, run, get as far away as you can, as quickly as you can. Why would that be? The guy that they're talking about worships a god, or not worships, but honors a god of forces, an alien god, it says. Hmm. Now, the alien god is going to give him technology to strike down the resistance, if you wish, in the fortresses of the world, the strong forces he can overcome them with, the strength of the technology he gets from the alien god. Now, since the Antichrist of this time will be one who honors force, a dictatorial, tyrannical force, what would he accomplish if he were to put an atom bomb, which makes desolate, in the middle of the temple of Jerusalem, where you have Christian faith, Muslim faith, Mormons, all the major religions of the earth are there headquartered in Jerusalem. And he says, I'm going to put this here in the temple, and if one of you sneezes, I'm going to blow up your holy sites. Now that is what makes desolate. When you get into the Hebrew, it's not a person. It is a device. It's a thing that makes desolate. And an atom bomb would do it. And an atom bomb would be a use of force by the Antichrist, just like Daniel said. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, there's no question that the Arab world would come to heel if you threatened Mecca in that way. If there was a way they could not disarm it, and they knew that you were going to lay that holy place to waste, they would obey.
Yep.
It's the only language they understand.
Force them to get along. Yeah, and I think it does go off, though. That's why they have to get out of town in a hurry. And the new holy city of Jerusalem will descend when the Messiah returns and sit over the ashes, I guess. I don't know.
Well, one of the interesting things about Jerusalem, and I've never been there, but I have friends there, is that it is covered with subterranean caverns.
Yes.
That's how they survived every conquest over the ages. The Babylonians, etc., everybody that came in and ransacked Jerusalem never got everybody because they, protected themselves down in the caverns, and they're almost endless down there.
Yeah, I think there will probably be survivors, but I wouldn't want to be underneath, at ground zero for a nuclear hit over some caverns there in the limestone. I don't know whether it will actually come to that, but it is. They tell you to leave town when you see that. It might mean that because when the Antichrist puts that there, he's then going to round up all the Jews in town and do them in or something. I don't know. But as I say, when you translate back to the original roots of the language, you don't get a person putting a pig in the altar. You get a device wiping out everything.
Sure, sure. And, of course, when you talk about an Antichrist, the Old Testament doesn't go into a lot of detail about that, but the New Testament does.
Right. Yeah, well, Daniel's kind of Old Testament, and there's a lot in the book of Daniel that I haven't even had a chance to retranslate. But there's one of the codes I saw in there. I mean, Daniel was, boy, he was a bright sucker. He used Sumerian words. He used Arabic words. He used Aramaic. He used, which was Chaldean Hebrew, and Hebrew. And there was one place in there which really just bothered all of us in the old days about what did it meant. When it said the Antichrist would put himself above the God of gods, the desire of women, and every other god. Now, we kind of took that to mean he's going to be a fairy or something, put himself, above the desire of women. But Daniel was using only a phrase or known in the Jewish community, and that was that the women of Israel wanted to be the mother of the Messiah. The desire of the women was to be the mother of the Messiah, who was going to be the Son of God. So when you read it that way, it translates as, he put himself above the God of gods, the Son of God, and every other god. Do you see?
Wow, I see. Yeah, exactly.
And the word above every other god is three words, Al, Kal, El, and every one of them ends in the letter El, or Lamed, which is a snake. It's the tallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It sits in the middle of the alphabet like our L does. It is called the wisdom letter, the giver of wisdom in the mystery schools, Hebrew mystery schools. And that tells you that you're looking at Lamed, 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 like 666 almost, and that is the sign of Satan, the giving of wisdom when he shouldn't have to Adam and Eve in the garden. There's just so many things hidden in there. I just sit back and ponder when you find something like that and think, wow, what else is in there?
Well, I mean, that's one of the places where we lose, most Christians and most scientists as well, is the whole story of Adam and Eve, the whole idea that God or gods came to this planet and said, okay, you, Adam and Eve, you're the prime pair of pure humans. And I guess one of the questions I've always asked myself is, all right, we had 6 days go by, and then the Lord rested. But during that seventh day is when Lucifer came and ostensibly tempted Eve. Eve partook of the fruit, whatever that symbolism might be, and then she got Adam to partake, and they were both corrupted and had to be cast out of the Garden of Eden. Whether that means that, they partook of sexual intercourse or whatever, you can throw a lot of stuff in there that you want to. But the idea is, that crosses my mind, is what would have happened if they did not partake of the fruit, they resisted Lucifer, what would have happened on the eighth day? Would the Lord have allowed them to partake of the tree of knowledge of good and evil under supervision? Was the anger over the fact that Lucifer preempted the plan and did the same thing which has been done on other worlds?
I don't think so. I think that what Lucifer did, when he got in trouble, was not immediately at that point in time, when he told them to take the tree of knowledge to realize that they were naked and, to have awareness. What he was doing was what the good Lord said, let's let you go down there and take them from, they're in communication with me. I talk to them daily, all the time. I walk with them, they walk with me. We have a pipeline between us. And he said, now, you go down there and convince them to take the bite of the apple and to break the rule that I have set, to sin, in essence. Then you take them and their descendants on a trip to happy times and show me how your dictatorial structure, your tyranny, would work better than how I run the heavens now. At the end of that time, where we are now, all beings who have sided with the Messiah will be given that chance to have everlasting life from this point forward, not eternal, but everlasting from that time forward. And that will be their reward, and they will get the knowledge, but at the time, at the end of the virtual courtroom, and if they have sided with the Messiah, their doorway to God. That's the way it pans out.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure. But the enmity between Adam and Eve and Lucifer, the enmity that was placed between Lucifer and the seed of the woman, the thing that prevents Lucifer from taking over the bodies of all the, you know, progeny of Adam and Eve, that seems to me to be some level of rule or glory or something, because otherwise, you know, these very long-lived, very wise Luciferian beings would be taking us over right and left, and they probably are. But because we let them in, we voluntarily give up our sovereignty and let them in. What happens to the soulmates like you and Holly who come together and are one and do honor that covenant? What happens to them?
Well, I don't know. I guess there's going to be a rapture at some time or other in the first part of the tribulation, and we'll be taken up and given our forever bodies. I think our earthly bodies will fall behind, and you'll be dead to the people around it, but that our spirit will leave. I mean, Holly's even had a dream vision that showed her that. It's kind of like a, you know, white, you know, kind of like sparkling spirit comes out of the body and is caught up in the rapture. She saw us both go, so.
Well, it's going to be some exciting times. One of the prophecies is of the sign of the Son of Man. And some modern writings about that have said it's going to be called a comet or a planet. And the Hopis have a similar prophecy of the blue kachina that's going to show up in about this time. And as luck would have it, or cosmic coincidence, in November of this year, we have a comet that's coming into our solar system, and it's going to get so close to the sun that it is going to burn so brightly, it's going to off-gas so brightly, we'll be able to see it in the daytime. Do you think maybe these signs in the heavens are as the scriptures have foretold?
Well, I don't know that the comet Ison is the one that will do it, but it's a sun grazer, and when it comes close to the sun, it will cause a terrific mass ejection from the surface of the sun. It usually happens with sun grazers. Now, when it does, because it's such a large one and it's got so much, you know, energy in its light signature, what might happen is it might make the sign of the cross in a star field. You know, like the glare of it might make a cross in the heavens, which would be the sign of the Son of Man. What do you think about that?
I'm amazed. I don't know what this new pope is going to have in store for him. I don't know what other church leaders are seeing in this. I hope they don't take political advantage of it, but I hope people are inspired to say, you know, we're in that neighborhood, not only in time, but we're in that neighborhood cosmologically speaking with respect to the end of the age that Jesus spoke about in the book of Matthew. All things are lining up. All the forces are there. All the players are there. Anybody who doesn't see it is definitely not a scientist and probably not a student of the scriptures either.
Well, that's kind of a given, isn't it? Yeah. You know, in the New Testament, the Thessalonians that said, oh, you know, has the rapture come and gone? Were we left behind? And they were told, no, I tell you, the man of sin has to be revealed first. Before this time. So that means it's not a pre-trib, it's an early trib rapture, I think. You know, it might be 10 seconds after he's identified in the world.
That's true. But, you know, some would say we've already been through some tribulation, and that's more
interesting
in some areas than others. But, you know, I had droughts, and we've had, you know, red seas, and we've had fish die off, and we've had terrible disease. And we've certainly had warfare, and we've certainly had truce breakers and men practicing unnatural affection. All of those things we've had.
Yeah, we have, and they're a lot similar to the Egyptian plagues, yeah. 2 Thessalonians 2:3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. I don't know whether the falling away means the falling away of the faithful from the church, like with this new pope, maybe a bad deal, and a lot of the Catholics fall away and just lose their faith or something. I don't know. But it does say the man of sin has to be revealed before the rapture occurs in 2 Thessalonians. So,
well, I know the Mormons make great weight of that particular scripture. They say that the restoration of the church, which happened in 1830 when Joseph Smith saw his first vision as a 14-year-old boy, that this is what began the restoration after the falling away. However, the latter part of that, the son of perdition being revealed, that has not taken place yet.
All right, all right. It makes sense. I mean, look, I'm not pedantic on that, but you know, I went back to the Hebrew, as I told you, to try to get to the earliest roots of all the questionable things in the modern Christian version. One of them was a rapture. Now, you know, Noah and his family were taken by, you know, the Lord and said, look, build this ark, I'll take you to safety, I'll deliver you out of the judgment that's coming. That's a judgment. Now, the tribulation has tribulation before the last half, which is the judgments that fall upon the earth. Now, if you look at the scripture from the aspect of he will take care of you, I went back to the betrothal of Rachel to Isaac, you know, Abraham's son Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Abraham, being the pattern for God in this symbolism, sends his servants to a foreign land to get the bride and bring her back to Isaac. He was not allowed to set foot in the foreign land. The servants of Abraham did it. This was a prototype, if you wish, an archetype of the rapture event. Then the Hebrew wedding and betrothal ceremony talks about the bride being whipped away, you know, whisked away with a veil over at midnight by friends of the groom to a 7-day feast, wedding feast. Well, the bride and the groom get to know each other in the bridal chamber he's built in his father's home. This is a faraway place from the earth. The 7 days are 7 years. And Israel, it says, when it's invaded, and miraculously the Russians and the Germans that have come down, everything will be destroyed on the mountains of Israel. For 7 years, they will burn the weapons of war that are left behind.
Wow.
Do you see what I'm saying? It's close.
Stan, I wish we had another 3 hours, but we don't. And it's like this every time we get together.
I
want to thank Holly greatly for her work on your website. Thank you so much for putting X Squared Radio up there. And thank you for the great work that you do. And I promise not to make you a stranger again. We'll have you back on the program often.
Yeah, it's been about, six or seven years since we talked last on the radio anyway, wasn't it?
I don't think it's been that long, maybe 4 years, but gosh, time just goes too quickly, and the times are moving so fast now we can't let all this time go by. We'll have you back on.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the program. Stan's website is standeo.com. Be sure to visit Stan's Corner in there. There's a lot going on there, and a lot of research that Stan does in areas we didn't even cover tonight. But that's because we have our favorite areas we like to cover.
Absolutely.
All right. You be good. Have a wonderful, productive week, and be safe, my friend.
Thank you, Brooks. Bye. Night-night.
All right, my friends. Thank you so much for being part of X Squared Radio tonight. Stan Deo is a well-known voice out there, and we appreciate him coming on the program. Next week, we're going to try and have Dr. Krishner on here, I believe her name is. She is a researcher into DNA, and we're going to get to the root of it because there's some stuff that's been going on with the human DNA with respect to Sasquatch that a lot of people just don't know. I didn't know. A lot of people don't even think Sasquatch exists, but evidently she's been given some genetic material in the form of hair, and she's been able to do some research and has found a link. So you definitely do not want to miss next week's program right here at X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program, and we'll see you Don't forget to find the good in other people and help it to grow a little bit every day. And by doing so, you will eventually save the planet. I'm sorry, that was Dr. Ketchum. Dr. Ketchum and her Sasquatch DNA research. Join us next week right here on X Squared Radio.